Well, this is a work session.
Okay.
As we know from our dress. And there's not going to be action taken on them, but we're going to have some presentations from different individuals in the DWR. So the first item, I guess, we're going to have from you, Anise.
All right. Thank you.
Big game hunt schedule.
Yeah, if you could just maybe pass some of these down. Take one and pass it down.
This is back, huh?
Maybe, maybe not. That's what we're going to discuss.
Did we all?
Well, I figured the buck stops here. So if you would like to look at what I'm going to decide. So.
Is that enough?
Yeah, Jake's
we do.
Greedy.
We made it to the chair.
All right, so what I was asked to do is basically just kind of come back and relook at this hunt structure proposal that we had out a few years ago. It kind of was put aside because we wanted to concentrate on unit by unit hunting, and now we're just wondering whether we should pursue it or not as a division. And so what I did is I basically put what it would look together for 2014, and that's the color coded thing there. And then I put some background on kind of what we've done so far, and then where it is currently, and then how do we want to move forward. So some of the background is, as you all know, a few years back, there was some legislative changes that made it possible to actually move the general season deer hunt up to or could start as early as October 1st. Given that, the board asked us to maybe look at some options of moving hunts around to make either, you know, moving hunts around or providing a little bit different opportunity or spreading hunting pressure, those type of things. So in June of 2009, we presented two possible options to the Wildlife Board. And one of them was this one, and then one was fairly similar, but just a little bit different. The general season part was the same, but the limited entry portion was different. And the option I have here now is the one that was favored by the board. And then they asked us to tweak it a little bit and then take it off of public comment. And then we did that in August 2009. We presented in November 2009. We took the proposal out as an informational to the RAC and then to the board in December. And then from that RAC process, we made some changes to it as well. And it mainly had to do with whether the muzzleloader, general season muzzleloader hunt came first, or the rifle hunt came first. Because in the first proposal, we had the general rifle hunt split into early and late, and then the muzzleloader was in the middle. But we heard from muzzleloaders that they would prefer to be first because it's a little bit more primitive weapon type, and they didn't want the rifle guys getting first crack at the deer and all of that. So we did make that modification, and then at that time we were ready to take it out again as a proposal for maybe the 2011 season. And that's when all the unit by unit things started coming up, and both the board and our chief at the time, our director at the time, decided to maybe put this aside because too much change at one time, maybe too much for the public to deal with, and then just do the unit by unit. So I guess where we are now is we're in the unit by unit hunting. We just want to get kind of a feel of, you know, if the board still wanted to pursue this. We feel it's still a good option to spread out hunting pressure, but we wanted to get kind of a feel of it before we pursued it as a something that we wanted to do down the line.
Anish, for the benefit of the folks that are new to this,
sure.
Would it be fair to say that the proposal for the hunt structure change, given minor tweaking, and near universal support?
Yeah. So I kind of glanced over some of that stuff. So yeah, the public for the most part, you know, thought it was a good idea. There were, you know, as I mentioned, some comments that we gathered both through the RAC process and, you know, with some other interested parties wrote us emails and other correspondence. But yeah, for the most part, people were good with the change that we were going to recommend. You know, some of those things that they agreed with is a fixed hunt start date. So it wouldn't always start on the first Saturday. It would be like the 20th of the month. So that would be the when you would start that hunt every year, regardless of what day of the week that would be, unless it was a Sunday, because we do have legislation that says we can't start a hunt on a Sunday. So if that's the case, we would move it one way or the other to make it work. And that was one that most people favored. They also liked the fact that we're splitting hunting pressure on the general season. They also liked the fact of deer and elk hunters being able to hunt at the same time for those people that have limited time to go hunting. They can do both at the same time if they so chose, and so on and so forth. So there wasn't
completely universal support for all of that.
No, there wasn't.
I mean, I can remember there was some concern about having two general season deer hunts. There was concern that sometimes less pressure
increases,
few things like that. Having the deer and the elk hunt together, I remember that was a little touchy. But.
Yeah, no, I agree. There were some concerns, and certainly, you know, we can't address everybody's concerns in any one hunt structure, but we try to make it so the majority would be able to support it. But with that, I mean,
what's their concern about having the deer and the elk at the same
time?
Well,
the one concern came mostly from elk hunters because they're used to, they're fewer.
Being by themselves.
They're fewer, yeah, so that they would have, you know, deer hunters in the field with them. But a lot of deer hunters are also elk hunters, so I don't think it may not be as big of a, you know, number.
If you don't hunt in the same unit for deer as you hunt elk,
right.
Makes it tough there.
Right.
That's the exact reason I personally don't like it.
You could still do it, though. You could hunt early with one for one in one unit and late for one in another unit for deer. So
yeah.
you could still do that.
You could do that.
Yeah. Are your tags an early tag or a late tag, one or the other?
Yeah.
So we split the elk as well.
Yeah, there would be separate permits, so you could either choose to hunt just deer or just elk or both, whatever permits you...
You could combine them or you could do them separately.
Right, yeah.
I know at one point in some of the cattlemen's meetings, they were concerned of moving the hunt ahead because then you still have a lot of livestock in the field and it tends to scatter things. I know that was a concern about having an early hunt.
That's why the hunter success goes up. Everybody takes something home.
There you go.
Yeah, and that was one of the
well, if you don't have a problem with the livestock and taking something home, I guess it works both ways then.
Yeah. And that was one of the comments that came through the public process, and that combined with the muzzleloaders wanting their hunt to remain early helped us push that muzzleloader to the early, so we're not starting so early. Initially, the first rifle hunt started, you know, the beginning part of October, and that both had the ranchers worried and the muzzleloaders as well. So.
If you don't get any rain or snow, you may not have to worry about it.
That's true.
May not be on the mountain.
That's true.
But you know, in any case, it's something that's been around for a while. The board's seen it more times than the public, because we kind of went through a stepwise process. But the public has seen it, and we made the changes that we got through the public process, and we were just ready to kind of get it out there as a recommendation when we decided to table it. So it could still work under the unit by unit. It wouldn't change a whole lot, and then we could move forward
I got an elk hunting question that kind of ties into what we'll be talking about tomorrow. I've been getting a lot of blowback on the Wasatch because we were going to increase tags here a few years ago. We decided not to increase them, then the next year we done away with it. And there's a lot of people concerned that the, especially on that unit, those elk survive the hunts and then buddy up and come out on the faces above town with
their buddies and get whacked. Sure. So why couldn't we take some of those permits on some of the units and run those with the, those big bolt permits, run those with the spike hunters, deer hunters? I mean, it wouldn't be near as quality hunt. There'd be leaves on the trees, there'd be pressure. I mean, you wouldn't put so much pressure on your big bulls. I mean, I think that'd be more of a pick whatever big bull you can find hunt, but I mean, we've thought about anything like that.
We have. I mean, but you get a whole lot of, there's a whole lot of reasons, you know, socially why we wouldn't do it. You know, the permit is a hard to draw permit if you hunt it during the rut, but that one would be easy. But then you get a complaint. There'll be the half a dozen guys that didn't realize they were going to be hunting with, and then we get that all the time, even now that we put it. So we try to separate the limited entry hunts from the general season hunts just for that reason, and that would make those units that way. I agree with you, the late hunt would probably have a pretty high success, but I don't think it'll be any higher than hunting in the rut. It's not going to change a whole lot from what it is now.
And you're right, the success rate, but the H class of bulls that guys are worried about seem to be pretty vulnerable at that
time. Yeah. You know what?
Once they've made it through because I mean that was, and the other thing is, well, we tried it. We wanted to increase the division wanted to increase permits. The RAC voted against it. The board decided not to do it. Then we did away with it. And now we're going to come back and put a bunch of permits on that.
The thing is, it has nothing to do with permit numbers. Permit numbers will
still. No, I know it doesn't have to do with permit numbers. But and what guys are worried about is the H class bulls.
Old bulls know how to avoid being hunted. And, you know, I don't buy that. Once they get shot at once, when that season comes around the next year, they're not going to be in the same spot. So, you know, even if they do, I mean, that's why we provide that opportunity, so they can kill big bulls on those units. So, you know, we can't have it both ways. We're providing opportunity on a limited entry basis to kill big bulls, yet we want to protect all the big bulls.
I don't think it's so much just protect the big bulls, but they've made it through. They're skinny, bony. I mean, the big bull I shot on the Manti last year, this table has more fat on it than he had. And they're right there by town, and they come out above town.
Yeah, and you know, that's a concern. So, I agree with you. I don't, you know, just, but we do it.
That's what I've been hearing.
But we do it on almost every other unit in the state. So I don't know why the Wasatch should be that much different. It's a big unit, and not all the bulls come up on the face. So anyway,
are the concerns I've been hearing.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. And, you know, we heard very few through the racks. It was, you know, a little bit here and there, and nobody really, I do realize, and I talk probably the same people that you've talked to, and they shared those same concerns with me. But
guys I work with. So.
Yeah.
I wonder if, you know, if we started putting those big bull tags on top of a general season deer or elk or anything, our law enforcement guys' phones might start lighting up when people are hauling a big bull out of the different time of year than people are expecting to see them. So.
Yeah, so I mean, those are valid concerns. I say, you know, if we start seeing that, and we may see it the first year, but I bet, you know, those older bulls don't get old. You know, they survive a rut hunt, which is probably, and they're more stupid than they would be in the late winter, so, or the late fall. It's a November hunt, so. Again, we do it on other units. It doesn't seem to.
I'd probably tend to agree with that. I think that the overall permit numbers would have a lot more effect on H class and that than when.
I agree. And if we start seeing, you know, that, then we can kind of look at it and change our strategy. Yeah.
Cut permits.
Yeah. I don't. We'll compare the ages from the old versus the late hunt.
Yeah. I guess we still have that information, don't we?
So we can tell whether that's happening or not. And that's the nice thing about our system is it bases management on real time harvest data, so we can modify things. And you know, we're not hunting a segment of the population that can't recover. So I think we're in pretty good shape that way.
Hey, Anish, let's for my sake try to do this a little bit different what we're doing. Let's start month by month and go through there and address it. so that we're not jumping around in all the pockets.
Yeah,
you got it. And the first one I see is the general season archery deer / spike elk.
Mm-hmm.
Now that / spike elk, that's the 12,000 spikes or whatever we're shooting.
Yeah, 15,000 total.
15,000.
Yeah. Well, no, this is actually archery, which is separate from the 15,000.
So it's totally archery right there.
Yeah, those are unlimited. They usually end up being around 11,000 hunters. And that's the way it currently is. So we're not adding
any. There's not a real problem.
No. This is right now, general season, deer and elk happens at the same time, and then limited entry elk happens at the same time as well. What we've done is moved limited entry, and we could talk about it. It moves into September more. So the limited entry archers for elk are hunting closer to the rut than they used to currently.
By a week or how many days?
Yeah, so as you can see, the limited entry
archers. Would that start on the same Friday every year?
It would. It would start on the 5th of September. Right. So it wouldn't be a Friday, maybe.
It'd start on that date. Then.
Right, okay. Yeah.
It looks to me like it slides it up probably what it usually be about 4 days, or yeah. Slides it back 4 days.
Yeah, so you're hunting into the 19th of,
September, 14th or 15th.
Yeah, some years it'll get to the 19th, but not every year. So this will fix it, so you're always, the latter end of the archery hunt will always be in the rut, or, you know,
a little closer
to the rut.
Yeah.
But yeah, September really didn't change a whole lot for general season. We still hunt deer, elk, and any bull at the same time. It will start on the 20th or the closest to the 20th every year. That way, people get more used to knowing that that's kind of the day they'll start every year.
So that archery bull elk is going to go to the 19th, theoretically, each month.
Right.
Each year.
Yeah.
That and your limited entry.
Yeah, that's a limited entry archery.
Okay.
And you know that we could certainly make some minor modifications there if we needed to. Right now we've made it 7 days that they're hunting without other spike hunters or whatever. We could tweak it to make it 7 days so they would be guaranteed 2 weeks in the field without being interrupted by spike hunters or whatever. Those 2 weeks closest to the rut. And then after that, the muzzle loader opens, which in the past has been later. And then they actually hunt 4 days by themselves, and then the rifle hunters can hunt while the muzzle loaders are still in the field.
Just unlimited entry elk.
Unlimited entry elk, yeah.
Two,
so
three,
that would give the muzzle loader guys the first crack at it during the rut, and then the rifle hunters would still be hunting during the rut.
We talked quite a bit about that when we went over this before. Mm-hmm. Didn't you say, it seems like there was some concern about that, but the data showed that most muzzleloader limited entry hunters were done.
Yeah.
A big majority of them, percentage-wise, were done by the time the rifle.
Yeah, and that's what we based this on. So the data shows but most muzzleloader hunters on limited entry hunt 4 to 5 days. So, and they're usually harvested by then, and then given that they're going to be in the rut, it'll probably be even quicker them harvesting. So we picked that time frame. Most of the muzzleloaders will be done by the time the rifle hunters start. So
there might be a little overlap.
Yeah, there may be. Those guys that are holding out for, you know, a huge bull or whatever may still be in the field. You know, but at that point they would have to put orange on because there's a center fire rifle hunt going on, but they can still hunt with a muzzleloader.
And there you're talking that last week in September.
Yeah. Yep.
That's the overlap you're talking about.
Yeah, it'll be in September, like 24th through October 2nd or so.
Why are the muzzleloader seasons longer than the rifle seasons?
Well, on this one they are because they overlap. So we're giving them 4 days ahead by themselves without competing with rifle hunters, and then they end at the same time. That's why it's longer for this one.
But then if I go to general season muzzleloader and general season rifle, it happens again.
Yeah, they just traditionally they have been. It's a little bit harder weapon type to harvest with. So that's kind of how it's been traditionally. So we tried to keep it the same length
Is that still true about muzzleloader? I mean, they've come so far with ballistics and ability to shoot longer ranges. And,
certainly.
I mean, it doesn't seem like a primitive weapon anymore.
It isn't that primitive, but we still limit them. They can't have any scopes on them, so they can't really see far enough to shoot.
You can have one power scope, which is a negative magnification.
Right. They either have to open sight or one power magnification. And that limits them on how far they can shoot. Not the ballistics themselves, but that limits. Agreed that the success rates are fairly similar, but they are probably more a fact of because they get first crack at the deer than it is because of the weapon type is similar. So that they're probably shooting at a deer that hasn't heard a shot yet, and then that does increase success rates. And that's why they want it to remain.
A lot of them are still in the velvet. I mean, I've seen several deer this year killed that are still in the velvet. Yeah. They haven't moved into the trees yet and stuff. So
in that time of year, you can pattern mule deer a lot easier. So there's some benefits to hunting them early. And so that's probably more a product of why their success rate is higher than it is of the ballistics of the weapon.
However, if you added scopes onto muzzleloader, your success rate would probably go up significantly higher than the rifle.
Yeah. I don't know if it'll go up significantly. It would go up, certainly, but, it'd be hard to say.
Just last year, muzzleloader success was higher than rifle, wasn't it?
We don't have the rifle data.
Last year? This season or the season prior?
Season past, pardon me.
No, it wasn't higher. Muzzleloader is usually 1% or 2% below rifle. It reaches the same, gets close to the same, but it's never higher than rifle. I'm talking long-term averages. It could be anomalies on certain years that happens, but. So that takes us into September. Basically, September we wrap up the archery hunts, and then start the limited entry.
Anise, I got a question there.
Sure.
Youth bull hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That's starting in the middle of the week. What does that do for?
You know, it's one of those things where if you start it on a specific day of the month. It may be a weekend one year, it may be middle of the week another year. On 2014, it'll be middle of the week.
But it always only gives them one weekend.
Right.
I guess it could eventually give them maybe two.
Yeah, there are years, because it is 9 days, where it'll encompass two weekends. Won't be every year.
Friday.
Well, maybe it is seven. Yeah, 7 days.
Could go Saturday.
Seven. It could go. It could encompass two weekends on some years.
It's 9 days.
It is 9 days. You're right.
It's 9 days on the schedule.
So, and if it starts on a Friday or a Saturday, it'll get 2 weekends.
Yeah. So.
Have you had that? I'm not familiar with it. Have we had that where it started on weekends before? Or is it?
It usually starts the same. Right now, it starts the same time as the limited entry elk hunt, which is usually a Saturday. So right now. It's like all of our hunts. They start on a specific day.
Participation with being like that.
We won't lose participation. I mean, it's only 400 permits roughly, and there are more people putting in for it than there are permits, because it's hunting elk in the rut. So you're gonna get participation no matter what day it starts. I mean, they may not be able to go hunting until that Saturday, but they're still gonna be hunting. And in some years it will start on the Saturday, so it's kind of trade-offs you have when you implement a certain system. You're going to have some things that may not be ideal, but you just kind of have to.
And from there you go into October.
Yeah, October is when most of our general season hunting happens on deer and elk, and with rifle and muzzleloader, and as you can see. The muzzleloader elk and deer, and then the limited entry muzzleloader deer happen at the same time. They currently do as well. So, but they're on different units. Well, the elk and the deer aren't on different, but the deer So you can have them because our low minute entry units are separate. And that's the way it currently is too. And then we have an early rifle season and then a late rifle season, which would basically be splitting hunters into two groups. It's not gonna, like, it may increase harvest a little bit because fewer people in the field sometimes will increase harvest because they have less competition and so on. So, but as we know, we can adjust permits if that does happen. It will still be a better hunting opportunity or experience if there's fewer people in the field.
But it's going to make a huge difference in the cache, the biggest units in the state. We've
right.
got the highest hunter density on public land anywhere in the state. It's unparalleled, I believe, anywhere else around the state in terms of hunters per square mile. And splitting it into two seasons will make that a far superior hunt.
How do you do the dedicated hunters on those?
One thing we did discuss a little bit. They would, I think if we split the rifle hunt, they would probably hunt all of other weapon types, but then they'd have to choose early or late on the, you know, again, these are discussions we'll have to have.
So if I wanted to hunt muzzleloader elk, but you didn't want to do deer until later, you could choose.
Yeah, so the permits will be separate. You could buy an early elk hunt and a late deer hunt or vice versa, whatever. Or you can hunt them both at the same time if that's what you wanted to do. The the deer permits are going to be draw permits, obviously, because we're in the 30 units and all that. So you'd have to draw a deer permit, but I think we'll still be able to sell the elk permits over the counter like we have.
What do you project a difference on that early to late in the amount of hunters that apply on that?
It's hard to say. I think some people prefer hunting them early because the weather's nicer. Some people prefer hunting them late because they might be closer to the rut and they're acting a little bit more stupid and they can kill a bigger buck. So it just depends on the people and, I don't know what motivates people. Until we start seeing how applications go, it's really hard to say. We would split permits, you know, probably 50-50 first to see how, and then once if success rate is higher on one versus the other, we may tweak permits a little bit. Again, it's something that will have to, it'll be data driven. So we get the information and then figure out.
And one year there is not going to prove anything at all, though.
Right.
Because the elephant in the tent is the weather
sure.
that year.
Right.
And if you get the right weather in the early season, the harvest will
yeah.
be completely different than the next year.
Yeah.
If the weather hits in the late.
You're right. Yeah. So, and then as with most things, we never base any, you know, long-term management decision on 1 year's data. We always try to get a few years in before we can really say a whole lot.
Going back to what Calvin talked about, the ranchers, because
mm-hmm.
I've had them talk to me.
Sure.
You know, that was their problem when that rule was changed, is pull those cows off the mountain
mm-hmm.
Early because of what
right.
well, this year they probably had to do it anyway.
A lot did.
Yeah. So with that, understanding that, and looking at this, it looks like to me the muzzleloader hunts is pretty much the same. The only thing that's impacting it is about 4 or 5 days earlier on the deer hunt.
Right. And keep in mind, there'll be fewer hunters out there because we're splitting them. So at least fewer deer hunters. And the elk hunters would be about the same. So, it should reduce the amount of traffic and all that's happening. And, yeah, you're right. It's only about 4 or 5 days on most years of when we start now. So it's not... our initial proposal put the first rifle deer hunt early, and that's why, because of the concerns of the livestock people and the muzzleloaders, we decided to make those two back to back.
So you're
from that puts 10,000 hunters in the field at the beginning of October,
right.
compared to $45,000 or something. $55,000.
When were you thinking about taking this out again?
You know, obviously, we're already setting permits for 2013, so I was thinking the following year. So it would be come back November next year as a proposal. We could take it out in the interim as an informational to get more input, but that's kind of, you know, what we're thinking. Again, I think it was something that we were asked to do, we did, and when we took it out, the public did seem to like it, so
I'll be honest with you, the more I look at it, the more I like what we have, especially with the 30 units being so new still and stuff. Mm-hmm.
There are those that
look
really
at it,
like
man, I'm kind of content to deal with what we got and keep working that system. But
the other thing I would think of is that, and I'm someone like John, but I know this has been around. If it was me, I would say let's feel it out like next August. Because invariably, very often in our RAC meetings, we get some good ideas that come through and we see the DWR adjust to them. You know? And if you just throw it out as an informational in August and see what's happened, that's when everybody's thinking about hunting. Then you come back in November and consolidate to find what your real proposal is.
Yeah.
That would be an idea to me. You do it that way just to get some input. Yeah. And you're going to have all kinds of input, I mean.
Sure.
Both sides of the spectrum.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't like the idea of deer and elk hunting at the same time. I just don't.
Wildly popular.
I've done it in Colorado, and I didn't like it at all. I'll tell you that. I just didn't like it.
Why? Too many people all at once?
Yeah, just people that hunt elk have different mentality and different ways of going about things. If you're hunting elk, then you are hunting deer. I mean, if you're all hunting deer, you kind of are all on the same page, and you kind of, if you're hunting elk, I mean, you're spotting for deer, and guys are out beating the hillsides trying to get the elk to run around. That was the trouble we had in Colorado. I didn't like it.
Right. Yeah.
I mean, I'm obviously one vote, one opinion. Well, but I don't think there's anything so wrong with the system we got that we need to.
One thing that drive us into putting deer and elk together is we looked at the satisfaction data from those that did have the deer and elk combo on the North Slope and in other areas, and they were raving about it. They loved hunting deer and elk together. So, you know, those are data points we used to drive some of this. And then we did get some that shared your view, but the majority that commented did like the fact that we can hunt deer and elk together. And a lot of it is driven by people's time constraints. So, you know, instead of having to take 2-3 weeks off to try to get both hunts in, they can take, you know, one good chunk of time and do both. Again, I'm not advocating for one or the other. I'm just trying to put the background behind it.
Anish, you had a presentation before, back in 2009, that kind of outlined pros and cons of going with the alternative hunt schedule or the new hunt schedule.
Uh-huh.
Some of those were decreased crowding, the ability for an individual to do both hunts at the same time and choose if he wanted to continue or take the one animal he had. I think there was some discussion that folks might harvest an elk and say, I'm done and not continue the deer hunt. Take my elk and go home, and that's it for the year. So our harvest rates might actually go down, which might allow an increase in tags if that pattern continues.
But when you say decrease in crowding, that's true for the deer, but it's not true for the elk.
Still got the same number of elk, but that's right.
But you're sharing the mountain with that many more deer hunters.
Yeah, that was a concern we did hear through the RAC process, is the elk hunters were the ones that probably were more disgruntled with this proposal than the deer hunters.
You go from sharing the state with $12,000, $13,000, $15,000, right, whatever we're up to now, to sharing it with, I mean, half of whatever it is, you're, it's a lot more hunters.
Yeah, it'll probably double the number on the elk hunt of people on the mountain. But you're right, harvest may or may not increase just because people, you know, if they have two tags in their pocket, they may just shoot one thing and call it good, depending on where they kill it and how easy it is to get out. So
when it comes to crowding, tell you what our mountain looks like. It looks like it's a camp out with trailers from middle of August to the end of October.
Right.
You know, I don't know, maybe only 5,000 carrying guns this week and 5,000 that week. There's 20,000 trailers up there.
Sure.
And people going around on four-wheelers, and it's still just...
You take the areas that have easy access, like Monroe and that.
In the world.
And the success that they've had on that spike hunt the last 3 or 4 years, I think that you'll see a huge amount of people up there on that.
Yeah.
It'll bother the deer hunters a lot more than them.
There's only
been all.
Yeah, I mean, again, these are things that we'll
some
have to look at.
Some units be like that and some won't.
Sure.
What I'm saying.
Yeah, and that's something we deal with now on a lot of things.
It's just cut out half the hunters.
Cut out half the deer hunters.
If you cut out half the hunters each week, you're going to decrease the number of people on the mountain each week.
For the deer hunters. But the deer hunters are used to. The elk hunters are still going to be looking at a lot more.
Okay.
Yeah.
The elk hunters are pretty
general season.
Yeah,
yeah. I've got a couple of thoughts in these.
Oh, you're doing a great job.
The board that gave you the direction of the December 2010 meeting is not the board that we've got now.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that this board would support reducing the rifle hunt for 60,000 rifle hunters or whatever it is, 50,000, and making that hunt shorter when all the biological information and the division recommendations and the raw floor recommendations have always been, and the division's data has always supported that shortening the hunt didn't affect the harvest.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't part of your proposal before, and I don't know that it needs to be part of the proposal that we take to the public now. Now, we may end up there, and if we do, so be it.
Mm-hmm.
But the previous board believed, as a majority, shortening the hunt would produce more bucks, leave more bucks, and that having more bucks in the herd would increase the fertility rates on the does, and therefore we would quickly grow the deer herd. And I'm not sure that the collective group here would have that same opinion based on all the data that you've shown us in the past.
Yeah.
So that's one change. Another change in here is that the moose hunt goes from 40 days to 18 days. And we haven't discussed that.
Didn't we have quite a discussion about that when this went around before about the moose hunt? I thought that was part of
the moose hunt doesn't change a whole lot. It goes basically starts September 20th and doesn't end until the end of October.
I said it goes 9:20 to 10:30.
That's 40 days.
Yeah.
I think that was something that got addressed the first time, and that the division just changed in their proposal.
Yeah, we've already done this. Change that's in here for moose is already.
I'm sorry. Sorry. It's the other way around.
Yeah, it's already been addressed.
Last one was 9:24 to 10:11.
No, it's that this change that's in here for moose has already been done actually, so we probably disregard that.
The other one then.
Changed
is back in December 2009, you stated that there was a DWR proposal to take out, or part of the proposal was going to be that antlerless permit hunters could take their antlerless animal during the general season hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see that in here.
That's already been done.
It has?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but
it was this year. Yeah.
Any antlerless home hunter could take
it? As long as it's in the same area that their antlerless permit is, they can take it during the rifle, muzzleloader.
Okay, stand corrected on that then.
Yeah.
Me and Calvin voted that in when you were watching.
Good on you.
So some of the things we discussed in, like the moose thing and that, we took, that made sense already. We kind of already done them, and
okay.
But this one was a big change, so we left it alone.
The deer part.
Yeah.
Where does the spike elk fall into this?
It's during the deer.
The spike elk is during the general
deer
season.
General
yeah.
season?
Yeah, elk. So it'll be both spike and any bull elk will be during that time for manure.
Let me ask then, when would you want to take this out informational? Because if we were shooting for a 2014 implementation, December 2013, a year from now,
mm-hmm.
decision. Would you want to wait till August to take it out, or would you want to go out informational before then?
You know,
does that only give us 2 years of 30 unit data?
Yeah. Well, we won't quite have 2 years if we do it for 20.
And that's a lot of changes.
I'm kind of new on this, so I don't know what I'm supposed to be observing or talking, but maybe I could give you my concerns.
Don't vote, okay.
All right. Turn that recorder off.
We'll cut you off. We don't like what you're saying.
You know, if we take this out next August or any time before the hunt, we'll have had only one hunt before we're talking about changing, even though it might have some delayed implementation. We have, I think, several things that we need to address. We have, you know, all of you have heard, you know, this has ruined the family hunting, I couldn't draw my permit, all of those things. But another thing that we're going to have to address as we come into setting permit numbers is, and all of our regions are out working closely on classification data now, but we may be needing to adjust, you know, permit numbers by units to sort of reflect what happened with this fall's hunt. We kind of went into this not exactly sure how to align all these between the 30 units, but we said, you know, we'll do it for a year, we'll come back and see where we maybe had too many hunters on a unit or too few, and that'll be reflected in the buck-doe ratio. So I think by this spring, we might be juggling around these permit numbers on these units already is going to have some impact. I think a lot of our hunters are going to try to figure out strategies now that they've seen a year of archery and muzzleloader and rifle on 30 different units this state. I think we got everybody tipped on their head pretty much even now after we've done this for a year. I guess I'd be nervous seeing us in August after only one of these hunts taking a pretty major change back out. But and I do agree with some of the comments and Ernie, you know, that some of these units like the cache where they get stacked on top of each other, it'd be nice to not see some of that pressure, but I don't know. I think we're still taking some pretty big public relations blows.
Some of these issues, like Ernie's mentioned on the castle, some of that could be addressed to some degree with the 30 unit situation that we're in. I mean, because we can control the number of hunters that are there. You can address that problem with the number of permits.
Where are you going to put them?
Well,
or are you just going to count permits?
Well, we don't know yet. That's the thing. We don't know yet because we haven't seen what. There might be more room on a lot of these other units that we don't know. There may not. We may be. I mean,
well,
that's my concern is that we're.
John,
we're piling,
showing that though in the past.
But Ernie, like, we're piling change on top of change on top of confusion here.
I'll buy the change discussion, no problem. But talking about moving permits from the cache. We already know the cache has got the highest hunter density in the northern region of anywhere in the state. And we already know the southern region's got the lowest hunter density and the best hunter success anywhere in the state. So let's say once again, let's say we take 10,000 permits from the northern region and move them to the southern region. How do you think that's going to go?
We don't manage on regions, Ernie.
manage on units?
I go from 10,000 permits on the northern region units and move them to the southern region units.
We don't know what's going to happen yet. That's what I'm saying.
I know what's going to happen with that discussion.
But we don't know if that's what needs to happen yet. But this is just stirring a pot that hasn't settled yet, in my opinion. That's all I'm saying.
Has there been demand? Have people been beating down your doors to bring this back out again?
Certainly, I've heard about it, yeah. But I mean, nobody ever beats down my door on anything, but...
Until you make a decision.
Right. I've since we passed unit by unit, people have come to me and said, we really like the Hunt proposal. When are we gonna see that again? So, yeah, I have heard that. I mean, again, I only hear from those who like something or dislike something. So it's not like...
And I'm not saying not do it, but I'm saying we ought to let the dust settle on what we've just done and see the effect that has and get some data from that so that we have some data to plug into this to make it work.
That's
my concern.
And the reason we brought it back now is so we can plan in the future of, you know, how much input we need and so on. This doesn't have to go out in 2014 or ever if that's, you know, the consensus. It's just something we spent a lot of time working on. And I just wanted to know whether we were going to pursue it or not. And I'm just looking for direction, not pushing any agenda.
Do you want some direction? It was me. I tend to agree with Greg. And sort of what Jim had said earlier, you know. Let's hold it back another year. Let's get 2 years of this 30-unit information.
How soon do we get our data from this fall?
Surveys are underway now on the Hunter Success, and our guys are out in the field doing classifications right now as well. So, by mid-December we should have it, by mid-January?
By mid-January, early February, we start getting enough data to basically form a picture. We get data trickling in all the time, but it doesn't really, you know, show you the whole picture until about mid-February.
No, we usually run like 3 years on something to get data before we start.
We try. But keep it in mind.
We do.
You want to look at the last 8 years of data?
As far as harvest data, we have harvest data on these units, even though we haven't hunted them on a unit basis, and we have classification.
I'm just talking about hunter numbers and success rate and kind of that's all I'm talking about.
Yeah, and again, it's just one of those things that was on the back burner, and I just want to see where we're going to go with it, if anywhere. So.
One comment I'd make is, aside from the change issue, about maybe too much too soon, one thing that appeals to me about it is, just from a perception standpoint, it looks like we're creating more opportunity. Yeah. You know, as you look at how many hunts there are under this scenario that a person can try to choose from and try to do something with their family or individual, it looks like there's more opportunity that we're setting up, which is appealing to me in that regard.
Certainly more diverse, diverse opportunity.
Same opportunity, more options on how you take that opportunity.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right.
Yeah. I mean, from a social perspective, I'm just saying.
I like the idea of having early and late, because it does cut down on the number of guns any one weekend, you know.
Right. I'm the strong advocate in the room, I perceive, but I'm also very sensitive to the subject of and the discussion on change. And the rapidity of the change. So if the consensus of the board members here is that it's a question of how fast should we move, then I'm supportive if your collective opinion is that it's too quick to do it this year and we ought to push it a year before we have the discussion.
I would think it's a little quick, and I would think we'd probably need 2 years. I don't of data so that we kind of know how to plug it into this. I mean, as far as we'd have a better idea of how many hunters are going to be on each unit after we've done it for and made the adjustment and see how those adjustments, if we're close to the adjustments on the units and know how many hunters are going to roughly be on the units. Because I think the first year or two would be when any big swings would be as far as permit numbers on these units.
Right.
Yeah, you could have wild changes this next year.
Once we get a year or two of that out of the way, then I think we'd be in a lot better shape to do this, and people would kind of be used to the system we have, and then we could start going forward without blowing everybody away. So
that's a great point.
But I'll go back to one of my earliest comments. This was the biggest change that had been taken out to the public in 8 years or 10 years, and it was received extremely well. Wasn't universal. John's identified one option, one thing that I now remember more clearly, and that was the elk hunters weren't as enthused about it as the deer hunters. But generally speaking, it was very well accepted around the state, and it was moving forward without significant opposition. I don't think we've done anything that hasn't encountered a significant opposition that I can.
I'd agree with you there. But our landscape's a little different now with the 30-unit thing, and I'm just saying that.
Delay.
You know, how they go.
You're
right.
You know what I'm
saying. 2 years, you know, a couple of years so that we know, so that the tag shift settles down, and then take this out. Would I think would be appropriate? But.
Greg, did we sell all the licenses that were available of various?
We had a few box elder permits left over. Now, if you recall, part of the rule allowed the rolling forward. So when we got to the end of archery season, we said any leftover archery could move to muzzleloader and then to rifle. So on a few units, Cash, Box Elder, I think Camus. Anyway, a few units, we did move some through. And so I think the only thing that ended up left was a few Box Elder tags. So I'm curious to see how our success ends up, and how our hunter success, and how our, you know, buck to doe ratio success ends up. I guess for most everyone here has been around a long time, but if you recall, when we went to 5 units in about 1993, we kind of just did a survey then to see where people had been hunting, and that's how we chunked out the permits around the state. And I think for the next 10 years or so after that, Ernie and Bill in the northern region kind of had to address, how do we get stuck with all these tags? That was a pretty big issue for a long time, as we tried to look at ways to shift those around the state. So now going into this 30 unit, a year ago, we said, where did people hunt last year within units? But we still have some higher concentrations of permits in the northern region and different things. And I hope that this data that is it's revealed here in the next month doesn't cause the board to have to make too significant of changes, that we really have to stand back and go, wow, that's a bigger impact than we thought. You know, we want to keep that opportunity out there, but we do have a new way we manage permit numbers that we've really never had in the past.
It'd be interesting to see the hunter satisfaction information as it's gathered up. And dedicated hunters, how's that going to function under this?
As I mentioned, it'll be similar to what it is now, but they'll probably have to pick early or late a rifle instead of hunting both rifle seasons. Again, I don't know how that will work. That'll be a separate process that we'd have to work through and get, you know, because that rule is separate from this, so we'll have to figure out. We'll probably get a group together and try to figure out how the dedicated hunter program will work with this.
With the discussion on that, I think we ought to wait another year or so.
Yeah, I mean, that's
especially on, you know, bringing up that limited entry.
So that'd be a 2015
not limited entry dedicated hunter.
An action item to the board in December 2014, if the calendar stays the same, and taking it out to the public again and going through the informational and maybe redoing the survey for sure that we did prior to this one, doing it again, and doing that at some time frame that would support going to the RACs in action in 2013 and the board action in 2014.
Greg,
yep.
Thank you, Ernie.
Dale was looking here.
when does the deer deer plan? I mean, is this something that the...
It comes that same year, doesn't it?
The deer committee could weigh in on too, with the 1 year delay, to kind of line up with that too,
yeah.
Where you have the deer committee looking at it. And I know it's not just a deer issue, but
sure.
But then you have another source of input on the yeah. on the whole concept.
Yeah, it certainly would line up well.
2013 as well.
Next, Mike Volks, youth recruitment.
Thanks, Dale. Did everybody get copies of these two documents? Stacy put them in the Dropbox. I didn't want to print them off and kill another tree, so.
I got the 3 year thing to shit it, so I was telling him he needs 3 years to do his comments.
I'll have a Dropbox.
Yes, sir.
3 years, John.
That is correct.
There you go.
What's it called?
Transfer tags.
Got it.
We have limited ability to transfer documents or tags by statute within the division. It's specifically illegal to transfer any big game permit to anyone but the person who obtains the permit. So. A member of our public contacted me because they know my interest in recruitment and retention and gave me an idea that they wanted to float out there and see if we could possibly use a transfer system as a recruitment and retention tool. Their idea was for some of these limited entry tags, and once the lifetime tags are so hard to obtain, many of the people that are obtaining them are older, and they wanted the ability to transfer those to their children or their grandchildren so that they'd have a quality opportunity hunt opportunity early in their life and then jump into hunting because of that. I like the idea, so we went looking around, and actually Arizona has implemented the program similar to what was suggested to me. So I went and looked at Arizona's program, and they have the ability to transfer. They've created the ability to transfer. It's a parent, a grandparent, or a legal guardian that has a big game permit that can transfer that permit. And they can transfer it to their grandchild, or their child, or their legal minor child that they're the guardian of. The child has to be below the age of 18. They have to have all the other recommendations or requirements met, hunter education. They have to have, they can have to legally possess the permit that's being transferred to them. And the person who transfers the permit, the parent or guardian who transfers the permit, has to hunt with the child in the field. Their requirement is they have to be within 50 yards. They also included the ability to transfer a permit to a child with a life-threatening physical condition or a disability, permanent physical disability. So we looked at that program, and I talked to Marty. We initially thought we were going to be able to try to run something through the rack and board process without having to go to correct our statute, the transfer statute. In talking with Marty, he said the best approach was to probably develop some statutory language change and pursue that, and then come back and run the process through the rack and board process for people to flesh out the details. So he drafted some draft legislative language that I sent out to you guys as well that frames it so that we can do essentially the same thing Arizona is doing. So I guess what I'm looking at, since we got started so late in this business and we're going to run it through the rack and board process initially, we missed the deadline to file a division-sponsored bill with the legislator and get anything going this year. So that doesn't mean it couldn't happen if a legislator took up the cause and wanted to run with it on their own. But I guess what I wanted to do today was to talk to you guys about, is this something the board thinks we should pursue? If it is something the board thinks we should pursue, what kind of a timeline do you think we should take? And what approach or tactics or logistics do you think we should follow to implement it? Because it is going to require statutory change, and it will require a rule to flesh that out.
I've heard a lot of talk about this or something similar, and I've never heard anything negative about it. The one question I had for you, it would have to be legal guardian, parent or grandparent. Okay.
Unless the child is disabled or has a life threatening, and then that can come from anywhere.
Okay.
Parties had objections to these in the past and reservations because of creating property rights and ownership on permits. Do I remember things like that?
Yeah, you do. And we had that discussion, and Marty is comfortable with where this draft language would take us. I can say that. But he did have that concern.
But he's comfortable at this point.
A lot of that's revolved around people wanted to do some creative things with bonus or preference points,
that's
too,
right.
And I think
we've
stayed away from
that. Yeah, exactly.
This is general season.
Well, see, that's just it. Arizona is just a hunting permit, and we could do whatever is the pleasure of the board and the public, and limit it to once in a lifetime or open it up to everything.
Then one question would be, have we talked to Arizona to see if they're happy with this now that they've got it, or if they've had any?
Yeah, I did. I called down there. Gene Elms is their chief down there. I wanted to find out if there were any law enforcement issues. There appears to have been no law enforcement issues with the implementation of it at this point. And their recruitment and retention team really like it. They're not having a huge amount of people do this, a couple of hundred so far. But they think it's going to grow, and they like it.
Now, when you do this, when you transfer the tag, you're talking about, in some cases, hunters, sportsmen that are older now, and they want to donate the tag to a grandson, perhaps, or a granddaughter. And you're saying that they have to be within 50 feet of the person.
Arizona has 50 yards, but we can define that any way we want.
Well, I guess my question is, if this older person who donates the tag is incapable of hiking the mountain, does the kid's father be able to step in and assume that responsibility? Is that built into the statute? Because, I mean, that's may not be all that common, but it's certainly something that could happen. So that's the question I would have.
Yeah, generally speaking, people who put in for those permits are able to go on those hunts, or they wouldn't be putting in for them. However, this may create a reason to put Grandpa in, which is why I think you should keep the requirements.
That was my question.
And that's why I think he's...
That's why I asked you about a general season hunt. It seems to me the more permits you include being able to transfer, the more problematic you get, and the more issues you're going to run into. Yeah. I wouldn't have a problem at all if it was just general season. I mean, if a kid's got a parent or a grandpa that's got 15 elk points and has been putting in forever, is that the kid that really needs to be, you know, retained? Or is he already kind of... The general season deer seem to me an elk would...
But those are, John, those are the ones that people are talking to me about. They're drawing these tags, and they're saying, I've had my chance, and now I want to give my grandson a chance or my granddaughter a chance. And they're the ones that are asking for the ability for some of these higher preference ones to
better, be able to do it. I guess that would have to decide then if that...
However, that decision could be determined with the rule as opposed to being determined stated in the code, couldn't it?
Sure, yeah.
However, it ought to be thought out before.
Yeah.
I've had quite a few people talk to me about that. And most of them are elderly, and we've even seen some grandpas in here with sickness, cancer, or whatever, that they would have loved to have done that.
Yeah.
Yep.
And just thinking of people I've known and talked to about that, most of them are elderly, and a lot of them would have a tough time getting out, and they just want to pass it on. And they all want to do it to a grandson or somebody like that, you know.
But the requirement is
I think we need to do some thinking.
That person go out with the hunter.
Yeah, it is.
Is it?
Yes.
Or is it a requirement that an adult?
No,
it's the person who transfers the permit.
That's how it is.
Okay, so that would stop the person from putting in at 102.
That's.
You know what? What's the problem with that? You got one animal. The guy's been putting in there for 30 years. And he's going to give it to his kid. It's not hurting the herd.
I'm not a serious limited entry hunter, but boy, I can imagine.
And I don't think that you're going to see a lot of
it. The lists.
But I think we need to talk about it.
Well, yeah, you double your chances if you put in your 100-year-old grandpa.
I can give you some names of guys.
My kid puts in 2 points.
80 plus, and there's
still guys that have to been put in for a number of years.
Do the average limited entry guys presently put in when they're no longer capable of getting in?
Grandmas that don't own a gun that got 15 out points.
Well, we've seen a few people, a couple of guys I know that come to the board wanting their hunt rolled over because of cancer.
Yeah.
There's 80 plus.
Keep in mind, all this can be fleshed out by rule, and we can find out exactly what everybody wants to look like.
I think the concept.
I don't want to rubber
stamp. I think the concept is sound, and I'm definitely in favor of it. I think there might need to be some discussion as to what tags qualify. I might have some concerns on that. And as far as the timetable, I wouldn't rush it to do it. I'd just say do it as long as it takes to get it right. Because I think done right, it's going to be amazing. And there's going to be some good things.
I think there's some ways, and we could flesh them out later, but there's some creative ways we could do it, so I don't think this became overwhelmingly abused. Now, if everyone was afraid, now we've got all these people, we could say, if Grandpa draws the tag and the kid's 17 and he's already got 3 points, well, the dad, the Grandpa now is ineligible for 5 years or whatever. We could also say if that youth gets it, maybe they're now ineligible for 5 years too, and that maybe it could use up both of their points or something so that we don't get runaway rampant growth of points. But at least Grandpa's happy. His grandson got one. Grandson now's got to wait 5 years. So does Grandpa. I mean, there's a lot of things. I think the code thing says here, you can do this. Then we sit around and figure out how to do it, you know?
I don't know if we're doing a kid a favor by letting him draw two Pavone out tags 2 years in a row. Yeah. Like Greg's saying, if you do something like that. I don't know if as cool as it would be and as fun as a kid would think it is, I don't know if we wanted to go that far.
I'll tell you something else. I'd love to give a swan tag to my son, because he was when he was young, because he couldn't draw, and I drew one. And I'd love to have given him a swan tag, so he could go out with me and hunt swans. But we can't do that. That might be. You might want to take a look at upland game. You know, we have sage grouse permits. We have sharp tail. We have swans. You know, there are other options there too that are similar to general season that provide an opportunity.
I just think it's a good idea that we need to explore further.
Yes, I do too. I think the concept is sound.
I think I emailed the director a couple of years ago a letter I got from one of the policemen down in Richfield that was very supportive of this too. He referenced back to the Arizona law.
Let me just ask you a little bit logistically. We're looking, we could run this informational in 2013, we'd have to get statutory language 2014. That's probably going to mean we're not going to implement, because then we'd have to come back with a rule, and we wouldn't implement until 2015. If the statute change occurred this session, if at all possible, we could implement in 2014. The other option too is that we can run the rule and the statute change at the same time, flesh out the rule and the statute change next year, then we could implement after the statute change went into effect. We'd have to make the rule say contingent on statutory approval. I don't know, I'm just throwing it out to find out how we could best try to approach skinning this cat.
If you're suggesting it can't be a division bill, but if an individual legislator wanted to pick it up and run it this year, with support from SFW.
I think you'd have people lining up to support.
Why couldn't you run them both together?
It could go through this year.
I think you'd have people
lining up. It could go through this year and then do a.
We would have to beg forgiveness from the governor if it came out as a division.
Well, apparently him and Greg are on pretty good terms these days, so maybe he could talk to him.
The governor's staff beat Greg up.
No, that, you know, this is, many of you have brought up, this has been talked about for many years. This isn't the big new idea. You know, all of you have probably had some line of this conversation at some point. And we have legislators out there that are aware of this. We have other, you know, this is something that, you know, we've just wondered if this could ever really happen or be done. Other states have done. Other states have some other transfer provisions. You know, Idaho has one, not quite as liberal as this, but this isn't a new game, you know, in town. And so if it's something we could live with and then, you know, roll up our sleeves and figure out how we're comfortable, you know, the code change, the statute change, pretty broad, says we can do that. We've changed lots of codes to delegate authority back to the Wildlife Board over the years. Almost every year, I think, we've tried to have ended up with something that delegated some authority back to the board, and that's kind of what a code change here would do. And then say, if you guys can figure it out, do it. If not, it's a code change that means nothing. You know, so.
Go to the legislature and make it okay for us to decide how to do it.
Yeah, and our legislature has a lot of trust in the board, and they've done quite a bit of that in recent years. We did it with refunds. We went up and said, we want to do some refunds. We didn't try to tell them what all the refunds would be. We just said, you know, no refunds except as authorized by the Wildlife Board. And they passed that two, three years ago, Judy. Yeah. And then we came back and said, under what conditions would we ever give their, you know, money back? And this would be a very similar thing to that.
So if a bill was to be introduced by a legislator on this topic, then I think it would be just fine for the division to start working on a implementing rule based on the intent language of the bill.
Yeah, we will do that. Because I think the one option that we can do if it doesn't get ran this year is to run them both at the same time, and we'll flesh out the rule, a proposed rule for the rack and board process, and run it out with the legislation at the same time. And I think we can do that if it doesn't get ran this year. So we'll start working on that.
Okay.
Sounds good to me.
I think we can find somebody here.
I'd go for it. Very good, Mike. I like that idea.
Tomorrow.
Yeah. Standardization of rack minutes.
Yes.
I Next. Have five different regions. We got five different ways of doing it. It might be a pet peeve of mine, but I think every page needs to be numbered.
One thing I wasn't aware of on this bill, talking to Stacy one day, she raised it with me. Stacy, or the division, does have a set of guidelines for all the regions on the rack nets, but I didn't know that.
Well, I just thought maybe, you know, the secretaries or stenographers or the region manager says that's how we're going to do it.
Is there one region's set of minutes you prefer over another?
The ones that aren't 42 pages long.
Yeah. So Southern is out.
We all know that the central region is far and away the superior.
I don't think so.
The southern.
The southern region. Where you want to go, buddy? You'll be in the central region. Step outside and see where you're at. Central region.
If there's a central set of instructions.
There is.
I think we have a lot of fun following it, but, and I don't know what those instructions say, but I do think that when I've got 40 pages and they're not numbered, it's confusing to me. Because I make I print them out in most cases.
That's a good way to ensure.
And I make notes and ear tag them and then try to get them back in the right spot. It's a pain.
I agree. Yep. I like the summary of motions at the front.
That is very good.
Some of the racks do. And then we've got a couple of rack chairs here, and there's also some questions on just the general process as we change to this electronic drop box and stuff. Maybe the rack chair should be getting Dropbox too. For example, I don't think tickets, there's only one Rob identified to me that he's supposed to make a report back to his rack on what the board did at the meetings. But he doesn't get to see the board summary of motions anymore because he doesn't get the
Do you want to get it by email?
I didn't this last time.
But the central.
Then prior to that? Usually doesn't come
usually,
by email.
Usually, yes, but not this last time.
So, but if we put them on Dropbox,
yeah,
and also maybe something like when you send us out the minutes and the summary of motions, we quickly turn those, or at least the summary of motions, back to you. But we don't always know what other inputs have been made by who and what the final this is. The summary of motions is until just prior to the next board meeting when we get the next Dropbox. So maybe we ought to get those a little bit sooner and the rack chairs too.
Okay.
It's a good idea, Ernie.
And then what else, Rob?
I just need to make sure I follow the guideline, it sounds like, because my minutes go directly to Stacy a lot of times for the last rack. And then I make changes before I send it to my council members. So what you guys get and what is on the web is actually different than what I send my council members.
Go through the books.
Which is it's a timing issue.
Yeah. And sometimes important things are not put in the minutes by the transcriptionist. Like this last one had a reply from our member who voted in opposition to a couple things. And when I went through there, it wasn't there. I had to go on the division's webpage, listen to the recording to get it written down properly. So I probably need to get the recording from the region early on so that I can actually, if I make changes, I make them correctly too. And then try to get that to Stacy so she gets it to you guys. And things make sense.
Let me just one minute. When I bring this up, I want the rack chair to know they're doing a wonderful job. And I really appreciate what they're all doing. It's very, very good. That doesn't go for all the board, though.
Did you hear that?
Is it good, bad?
That's a warning. I'm getting my guns out.
One on each hip. I like that. So want to take a break? Fred, did you have something to add?
No, I didn't have anything to add except that I was wondering why I wasn't getting the summaries, and now I know it's because it went to Dropbox. And as soon as it went to Dropbox, then I didn't get summaries so that I couldn't report to the rack on what happened. Well, so if I get Dropbox...
It doesn't just go to Dropbox. I send an email with the file attached, and I place it in their Dropbox. But it sounds like this last set of emails didn't go, and we did switch from one email server to another, so we've had some issues with emails going through. So I will continue to do both. It will still go in Dropbox and still be attached to an email. I just need to double check some emails because it sounds like some of them have dropped off because that process has not changed.
Okay, that would be great because I actually did receive it the last two times.
Okay, but I'm more than happy to set you up on Dropbox if you want to do it that way too.
Anybody got anything else on that?
Now, and just so you're not being picked on, I think the transition, the transition to Dropbox is going very well, and you've done a damn good job.
It's nice. It's nice that you can go there and have everything. Instead of having to flip through all the emails and try to find it, you go to Dropbox and everything's there.
So you're saying my whining for iPads for 2 years was worth it?
I was on your side.
Kind of.
I was on your side.
You don't even know where the meetings are.
That's brutal.
Okay. Anything else on that subject?
Send an email once in a while.
Dropbox.
Why did I think that?
Okay, I'm going to move on to our next item, and that's Greg. He's done. I'm going to start calling Director Sheehan, right?
Sorry, I didn't realize you were up right now.
I'm up? Yep, you're up.
Holy cow. Brian Christensen's put together a spreadsheet on this. Really almost ties into some of what we talked about on this first agenda item about hunt schedules. Did you get this in your Dropbox? I don't even have a Dropbox.
Which one is it?
It's kind of colorful like that.
Dedicated hunter. Yeah, it's here.
Yeah. I haven't signed up for the Dropbox yet after Stacy trained me up on it.
I'm not.
Is what it looks like?
Yeah.
We have the electronic green friendly version.
Well, if you want to have some dead tree stuff, we got that here too. Does somebody want a copy?
Yeah, I want a copy.
Yeah. Some of this is green.
There is some green ink in there. So.
Yeah. I want to put this in. That one's printed on landscape.
She
just print them portrait. So this is much better.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Have
you got one, sir?
One more here's. Why not?
You're not even going to take one. It's printed off.
All right.
You know you don't want to take it and make an airplane, show the grandkids.
If there's extras, why don't you pass some around the room? We've got a lot of visitors in the room. I think it's probably enough if you guys want to take one of those and pass it around. Make sure the rack chairs especially get those, if you would, before we run out, clearing the corner there. I'm going to let Brian explain this. He built it. I think it's a good spreadsheet, but before he gets into the detail of it, there's two topics that have come up. One was, you know, a year ago as 30 units were created, everyone's like, how's this all going to go down with lifetime people and existing dedicated hunters and youth and all kinds of things. We worked pretty hard to come up with a process, and I think it worked out well, regardless of how people may have ended up, you know, getting whatever hunt they wanted last year. But anyway, this is just kind of the result. So we'll have Brian take a minute and then go from there.
And this is dedicated hunter.
It's dedicated lifetime and kind of letting you know how these permits were consumed by the people that had some level of entitlement, if that's our word of the year, to getting some of these tags. So go ahead, Brian.
Okay. So the big concern when we went to unit by unit, like Greg said, was what's going to happen to units that have small permit numbers when we guarantee lifetimers their choice before the drawing, and a certain portion of dedicated hunters. You know, anybody that existed before as a dedicated hunter, we switched them from region to a unit, and there was some uncertainty there of what might happen to a unit. So we watched it pretty closely during the application periods, and then right afterwards we watched the lifetime applications that came in and all the dedicated hunter choices that came about. And it was much to, I guess, our surprise, there were only two units that we really had to kind of pay really, really, really close attention to. And you can see those in it's Plateau Thousand Lakes, unit 25B, and then we did also kind of watch out for the Southwest Desert. And so we gave, if you glance at those two columns on this, it's the third to last and second to last columns. You can see in the colorful spreadsheet, there are some black and white ones around the room, but the colorful spreadsheet, they've got some red numbers there. And what this indicates is that we had a total of, got a slide over here, there we go, 400 permits is what was available on that unit, and 41.5% of the permits that were available were taken in advance by dedicated hunters switching from a region to a unit. So that's a pretty hefty number. And then we had 51.8% be taken by lifetimers. So that left only, you know, a handful of permits that we could actually issue in the drawing. And as part of that, because dedicated hunters, as part of the unit structure, we only let up to 15% of the quota be for dedicated hunters. It far overshot that 15%, causing another type of concern.
So in this case, they should have gotten no more than 60 permits of the 400.
Yeah.
But they got 160.
They got 100 and...
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. 166.
Okay.
Yep. So way overshot on that one. Similar thing occurred down on Southwest Desert, Unit 20. They got 109 permits, and that overshot, not by much, 15.6. So it was close to the 15, but it did go over. And so the big question on Dedicated Hunter is what's going to happen in the next year. The good news is that most of these people that chose that those two units as Dedicated Hunters are in their third year, and they won't be in the Dedicated Hunter program next year. We want them back, of course, but they won't be guaranteed that unit anymore.
So we're not stuck with overshooting it for 3 years or 2 years.
Nope. And I don't think you'll see that on the 1,000 Lake.
Because that great of a hunt.
Agreed.
We talked about that earlier. We were afraid of
cherry picking on the unit that got opened up.
We're going to find out.
What are the results on 1,000 Lakes? Do we have any preliminary?
Part of success or what?
Success, quality.
I did a check station just off the Fish Lake, so I did have quite a few 1,000 Lake folks come by, and I don't know what success percentage was, but there was some decent animals harvested. But that being said, it wasn't what a lot of people thought it was going to be, because it was the first year coming off of limited entry. That unit has particular problems that made it a poor limited entry unit, and that's why we did change it. So it wasn't what a lot of people thought it was going to be. But that being said, there was some decent animals too.
And Ernie, we won't have the results on the survey stuff until, like we talked about, until mid-January, early February. We've got muzzleloader results now. This muzzleloader survey's done, but archery hasn't started yet because you still have the extended archery hunts going, and rifle just started. So as far as dead satisfaction.
At least the anecdotal is it wasn't that great a hunt, and the word's going to get around, and those that put in this year probably wouldn't put in again next year.
Well, no, I think some people will put in, but what we need to realize is we knew this was going to be happening, because there's 2 years of Dedicated Hunters that get to choose, but when they're out of the program, it's a level playing field. So even though this is data that shows that there was a lot of people going to this unit, even if they choose to go there in the future, they won't be able to, because it will be limited to 15%. So this data, even though it shows a lot of Dedicated Hunters went there, that can't be a pattern, because they'll be limited to 15% once they've dropped out of the program.
Yeah, and on the plateau, we weren't able to offer any spots because it was over capacity before the drawing even occurred. So we didn't even offer that as an application spot. You couldn't even apply to be in it for that year. So we didn't have any new Dedicated Hunters last year on that unit. So if you go over one to the very last column in the Plateau 1,000 Lakes unit, you'll see that Dedicated Hunters will have those that are existing now, you know, this first and second year, or second and third year guys, could take up 13.8% of the tags. So they'll be under the 15%, which in theory lets us offer 1.2% of the permits as new Dedicated Hunters this year. So we could add a couple. But it, like Anise just said, it's going to be capped at that 15, and we'll have control over it again. The lifetimers seem to have some interest there, and they got about half the permits last year on that unit. But it's a little bit of a guess at this point on if all of those are willing to go back there again and hunt, or if they're going to go back to other units that they were on previously.
Any idea about where those hunters are coming from? Are they locals? Are they coming from all over the state? Anybody know?
I don't think we looked at that.
I worked with a bunch of guys that were all excited to go down there. I think they're
not. I don't think it was mostly locals, because the locals kind of know what the unit is. I think it was people that thought it was a limited entry unit. Now it's going to general season. There's got to be down there.
I know several guys that hunted that had never been on the unit for that exact reason. Anise just said, go get it,
and I don't in the long run, I also don't think they'll be able to hold 400 permits.
May not. That's part of that new plan that might shrink down.
Is there any way we could ask the folks that do the survey to survey those 117 as part of their survey?
To ask them what?
I have to ask Heather.
And ask the survey people to contact those 117 as part of the deer hunt survey that's going on.
For what purpose, Ernie?
Just determine 100 success.
We don't need to do all 117 to get success. We'll get a good estimate of success just with a decent sample size of 30 to 40. Just like we do on, you know what I mean?
But how do you know you're going to get 30 or 40 of a lifetime?
Oh, of the lifetime guys.
Yeah, because it's the lifetime guys that could do it again next year, potentially.
Yeah, we have a minimum sample size on each unit. I don't know if we have it broken out by different permit holder types.
We don't, but well, it should be. We can look at it by permit type, and it should be. We can compare it to the rest.
I mean, one thing we'll know is virtually all of those permits went to either lifetime guys or dedicated hunter. So in this case, we won't need to get too far in the weeds to be hitting lifetime guys. More than half of them are already lifetime guys. So,
I'm happy.
So the good news is a lot of these permits are going to be freed up and offered to the average applicant again. And I don't know that we see a real concern about what could happen with that unit next year like we were last year. Last year we had to watch it. And then the only other unit that came even close to, you know, causing any kind of concern was Southwest Desert going over the dedicated hunter cap by that 0.6%. And again, they dropped down from those expiring out of the program, dropped down to 5%, 5.7% of the unit take on that. All the other ones are down in single digits for the most part as far as what the dedicators are going to have next year.
Existing ones,
the ones that are going to be in the program. So it looks pretty healthy. Looks a lot less concerning.
You know, probably my favorite column on here isn't the one on the farthest to the right, but it's just one to the left of that. It says percent take of 2012 unit by lifetime. This was a big deal when we went into this. You know, what are the lifetime going to do? This year, the percent of our lifetime people versus all of our permits this year was 4.6%. So if you had a perfectly even distribution of our lifetime people through all the 30 units, if, as you look down through that column, the very first unit is 4.4%. So that's almost an exact distribution of permits issued. It looks pretty good as I look all the way down through that and realize we distribute our lifetime people pretty good. And that was kind of what we thought would happen as we went into this, is that even though there's 30 units, they seem to have a pretty good distribution from our surveys in the past around the state. And I think, except for this Thousand Lake unit, that I think will dilute itself soon. Our lifetime people, I don't think, are really presenting any impact at all on getting advantage of these hunts. If you just kind of keep the number 4.6 as you look down through that column, some of them are quite a bit less than that. So
the 3620, that's the total number of lifetime permits? The middle column?
Right.
At the bottom?
Yeah. That's how many we issued last year.
Oh, you know what? It might be a little over. I was thinking we were like 3,800. So, it would be even less than that. And so
it's only two units. Only those two units that even made double digits.
And so that is this a program that you can no longer get into, or can you?
Yeah,
get
it's ended about 1993.
So these numbers are going to
disperse,
decline.
Yeah, yeah. They'll go down over time.
What's the dedicated hunter percentage now?
15% per unit.
Well, no, but what's the?
Oh, how many are in it?
Compared to the total permit holders.
Well, there's about 5,500 dedicated hunters, I think, right now.
And
what is it? 53. So right in there, and we had about 88,000. So you're going to be just a little. You're going to be about
7%.
Yeah. Here, I'll get my phone out. So it's pretty low. So a lot of the fears that people had when we went into this, I think, are being alleviated. So if we had 5,300 divided by 86,500. Yeah, about 6.1%. out there now. You know, now that doesn't mean it couldn't grow this year. Our program will allow more dedicated hunters than that, but a few of the changes we've made in the last couple of years has reduced our number of dedicated hunters. So I don't know, you know, what questions you may have, but to wrap it up, I think it worked out pretty well.
The Thousand Lakes will take care of itself.
Yeah.
That Southwest Desert, I'm not familiar enough with it, but, you know, it might stay at that percentage for a long time. I don't know.
But the question had been, do we need to do anything statutorily? It appears the answer is no.
We talked early on, first went in, with Jim, you know, that plateau was going to Thousand Lakes was scary to everybody, but there was even then some indication that it wasn't as good as people might have thought it was going to be. So it's cleaned itself up. Southwest Desert.
You know,
I'd love to have a tag on the Southwest Desert. I'll take you, Henry, sir, first.
You know, any of these units that have very small permit numbers could see some, you know, deviations over time because, you know, a lot of these units are, you know, 3,000, 7,000, 4,000. When you get units down to 300, 400, you know, 700 tags, something weird could kind of pressure that. But I think we're fortunate in that this worked out pretty well.
Kind of sigh of relief, really, because there was a lot of questions about how that was going to be. And how
I think we all had those questions. Yeah. You know, what's going to happen? And it worked out pretty good, I think.
That's good.
Yeah. Well, you know, and Teresa mentioned there are a couple decent deer, and I've seen a picture of a a couple nice bucks off that unit, but I've seen nice pictures of deer off almost every unit in the state this year. You know, this was a good antler year, and so, I don't think the fear of one big buck picture and then everybody runs to that unit's going to apply because there are a lot of nice deer taking this year.
See, one me and Calvin got me spilled last night. Awesome.
Really?
Bambi. I did get a picture of that.
Yeah, permit for
that. That's one I showed you earlier.
Okay, we're done, Greg.
Director? Unless you've got any other questions and unless you want us to do any follow-up. So hopefully that helps.
Enactments were kind of interesting. Multiple comments on crowding this year or a lack thereof. And I heard comments on crowding again. On the units that we would almost expect to hear crowding comments in the northern region. But I also, in the southern region minutes, hit. There was nobody on the unit this year. It was a black and white change
of
what has existed for 30 years.
Yeah.
It's gone away.
And so how come?
We did what happened similar to 1993. We took the best information we had and distributed 86,500 permits around the state. Based on the best information. The other thing we had is we had some, we pushed a few more permits to muzzleloader because we went to the 2020-60. So that did a few changes. But I've also heard, and this is just anecdotal, I guess, if you will, for me talking to people, but we had some units that had extremely heavy perceived hunter pressure on them too. And we had some units that had no hunter. We didn't get it perfect. And that was what I mentioned earlier is that that'll all work itself out as we look at these buck doe ratios. Because in theory, if everybody piled into a unit this year because of how we distribute them, they would have gunned down a lot of these deer, and we would be cutting permits here. And similarly, if we had very few hunters there, we ought to have good buck numbers, and we'd be adding permits. So this will be a real test this year to see if the division and board has the fortitude to get through raising permits on some of these units that had perceived light pressure. I hope so, because if not, we're going to have what we had all through the 90s, which is the haves and have-nots on units, and that won't work well for the model we've tried to create here. So.
I think the big one in the southern region was not necessarily the amount of permits on the muzzleloader and the rifle. It was the amount of people that came in for the archery compared to earlier years. I think that's where a lot of that was coming from.
Okay, didn't say so specifically, but that's.
Are you saying that they felt like there was more or less, or that there that the crowding issue was
the
gone?
The crowding issue on the archery time of year was gone.
So there's no statewide anymore.
Yeah. That's where.
That could be too.
And not only that, but I've had landowners and CWMU people call me and tell me that the problems with trying to keep people out and the problems that they've had was almost nailed during that time of year. Because there wasn't so many people, and they're harder to catch with the fly on, you know, and everything like that. So that's people that hollered at me.
And these for Kevin, any comments? Is that kind of how you see it as well?
We're going to take the harvest data and the survey data and the classification data then, and all that's going to go into kind of a review of our hunter distribution and how did we
do. Anise, do you want to explain that?
So as you recall, the way we manage our general season deer units is by buck doe ratio. This does not take into consideration crowding. It takes into consideration how many hunters it takes to harvest a certain amount of bucks. So that's the way we will continue to do it. You know, obviously, if there's too many people on a unit, they're going to over harvest and we'll have lower buck doe ratios, as Greg mentioned, and the inverse is true. So we'll look at the data. I think our first stab at it was really good. I do think where most of the units are going to be right where they need to be. There may be some units we were probably light, and we erred on the light side on purpose. So we were, because it's not easier to add permits, but it's more palatable to have a better hunt than a lousier hunt on one year than another. So we erred on that side on purpose, and hopefully in the hope that this board and the RACs would allow us to increase permits if needed when it comes down to it. So I think most units are going to be right where they need to be. There will be some units where buck doe ratios are higher, and we will likely recommend more permits. And there may be one or two units where buck doe ratios drop. Although from just talking to biology preliminary data, it's not looking that way. Most buck doe ratios are up above. So, but I guess stay tuned, and we'll make the best recommendations we can based on the information we'll have. So,
right now, there's a horde of bucks out there, at least in the northern region. Most of them little ones, but they're all over the damn place.
Yeah, and that's what you expect.
Say that in the recording. Yeah. Let's put that on the internet.
They'll be big next year.
We need to find planned areas.
No, but I mean, I think overall, at least what I got through the RAC process from talking to people, most people were happy with this year's hunt. We usually after a deer hunt, when we have a November RAC, if people are not happy, they come in droves, and there was almost crickets at almost every meeting. So,
but right now we are. It isn't 10,500 permits under our 97,000. There's an adjustment in there.
So we're
8,000 or so permits short of what we could be issuing.
We don't know. I mean, everything's based on buck doe ratio.
Numerically.
Well, from it was. Yeah. But
86.5.
Yeah. We're right around 87 now, and we were at 97 at one time. So we're 10,000 permits below what we've tended historically. We may never get to that point, but if populations start to rebound, we may get to that point again. But it's all, you know, predicated on how many bucks we have on the unit, and that's the way we've decided, both as a board and as a public, to manage those units. And hopefully, we can stick to it. We can adjust permits as the populations rebound. Or
how many years of data are we going to look at before we make?
Well, we'll have 3 years. We have 3 years of data. We like to work on a 3-year average, but we will probably weigh this year a little heavier because it was different than the other year. So we'll look at the data every way we can to make sure we make the best decision possible. And we'll explain our recommendations when we make them and why we've made them and so on.
3 years?
What's that?
3 years of data.
Yeah, we've usually used 3-year average.
He has three now.
You're talking the way the May meeting now, right?
Or when we set permits.
The way you collect your post-hunt, post-harvest data
hasn't changed from what it was in years past, right?
It hasn't. It'll actually be better because now we're not asking the hunters to tell us where they hunted. We know that
what unit we're in.
So that information will be better than it has been in the past.
But your biologists that are out in the field, they're looking at the same areas that they've always looked at.
So
that's not going to change.
You certainly that continuity remains there. Comparing year
it's just
to year.
Now you're looking at those 30 units instead of the five.
Instead of the region. Yeah, we're not averaging on a region. We're just doing permits on a unit by unit basis, which, you know, should help us distribute hunters more evenly.
Hey, and it's just to make sure, I want to make sure that you and that John, you're not speaking over each other. We will make some adjustments this year. We're not going to wait till 3 years of unit by unit before making any adjustments.
I'm just wondering whether we use 1 year data to make that decision.
I just wanted to make sure.
But I mean, we're not.
We didn't surprise you when we came with changes this year.
No, there will be changes. I wouldn't expect them to be huge until we.
I think the first couple of years are likely to be bigger changes than later because it's going to take us. Now is when we're zeroing in.
Well, but Anise said he did a good job. Greg said that too. So if they did a good job, then we should be.
Are we saying that there's potential for this April meeting next year to be somewhat or more controversial than it has been in the past? Is there some recommendations for permit increases? I think
it might be.
Could be. Or there could be
decreases. I don't have any idea what it's going to do.
From my perspective, if we're in that situation and it looks like there could be some controversy, could we try and set up another work meeting before it goes out to the racks?
What time frame you got?
If Stacy can figure that all out, you know, I don't know when we have our recommendation data ready. You know, that's kind of drives it. But this is kind of a big deal. This is the first time we're balancing two things. It's your bucks and doe ratios, and we're trying to decide it. You know, units like the cash or where they ought to be with hunters. You know, it's kind of a big deal.
This one work meeting.
You have a work session scheduled the day before that board meeting.
Yeah. We do. Oh, the day before, but not before the racks. Goes to the racks.
No. Not before it goes
Didn't
to the racks.
We have one earlier this last spring, too? Like in April or something?
We'll figure it out. They will.
Anise, when do you think you might have recommendations ready on this general deer? I know some of the things take longer than others.
But. Yeah, the bucks and bulls, we'll probably have it figured out, you know, end of February. But then we always wait to get harvest data on the antlerless. So if we're just talking bucks and bulls, we could probably have something available March 1st or whatever.
So we've got a little bit of time.
In the March time frame if they want to have a... The thing is, I hesitate just because we're putting numbers out there prior to going to the public with them, and then, so it's just, are we superseding the process or not? That's the only concern I have. Is I don't, you know, we could report on them and say, you know, this is what we're recommending, but at that point, that recommendation's out there, and the public process pretty much started right there, and then we're going again through the public process with the actual recommendation. It makes it tricky for us because things do sometimes change between then and when we take things out, and then we always hear, well, you said this, and now you're saying this. And so we should have to be careful. It depends what
I guess maybe what you're thinking, Ernie, is, you know, if we're tweaking a little bit here and there, I don't know that anybody here is that concerned it goes through. Right. If we come in and this data shows that we should go from 86,000 permits to 65,000 permits, that could be a huge matter to address. You know what I mean? Conversely, if it says put 100,000 tags out there, that's probably a huge thing. So,
Once the data starts coming in, we'll start crunching it, and then, you know, if we feel that.
Because we'll talk to you between now and then. If it looks like there's going to be problems,
we can set something.
If it's going to be a big controversial topic, the board ought to be aware of it.
To be honest, I don't think it will be, as far as permits should not fluctuate a ton. But if we start seeing that, I mean, the rifle hunt is the one that drives most of our stuff, and we haven't seen that data yet. But if we see that and we think it's going to, you know, be, and then, you know, we'll have our our classification data done by January. So that information and the rifle hunt, we will start getting a picture of what it's going to look like. And if, you know, if we think it's warranted, I think Greg will make that call, and then we can
maybe even an emergency meeting if we had to or something. Or whatever we have. Stacy will have to train me up. I've seen her train you guys. I'm nervous about this. She throws stuff at you and yell at you.
Don't give her that kind of power. She'll take it without you giving it to her, so don't offer it up.
That ship has sailed.
Okay. Thanks, Director.
Thanks, Brian.
John?
I'm up here.
There we are.
Oh, wait, there's one topic here we didn't get into. How about we? I thought you were
the preference points thing.
Yeah, the general season deer preference point.
I could do that as well.
Let's do that.
Okay.
It'd be nice to do that so we don't have to drag it all out tomorrow.
Yeah. Let me give you a quick overview on that. We've had for quite a few years now. We put in place that if you didn't draw your first choice, this is just in the general deer hunt. Okay, this isn't any limited entry or elk or anything, just general deer. We put a thing, a process in place that if you didn't draw your first choice, but you do your second, third, fourth, or fifth, we'd still give you a point. So we're trying to make sure people give us five choices. Back at the time we did that, we still weren't selling through the draw all of our central tags, all of our northeast tags, and all of our northern region tags. And then they were getting gobbled up when we had our big sales days. And the problem that was creating is that people would say, I only want to apply for southern. If I don't get it, I'll just go buy one of these other regions over the counter. And so we put that in, and then all of a sudden people would go back to applying for all of them because, you know, and it relieved the pressure off of our front counters and our internet sales site and everything else. It worked pretty well. We've sort of trained everyone. Now we jump to 30 units, and some of these may appear to have a higher coveted nature than others as far as trying to get, you know, 1,000 lakes or some of these things. And people that maybe have a few more permits or preference points for whatever reason than someone else, an issue's been raised, talked about a little bit lightly in our RAC meetings, but why should a guy who has 3 points who doesn't draw the 1,000 lakes, for example, last year, but still draws a Pine Valley, which is pretty coveted, how come that guy still earns a point for drawing, which is still perceived a pretty good unit? So there's been some discussion out there. Why don't we just end that whole, if you get any tag now through the draw, your points are gone. You're, you know, done. Why are we rewarding you for that? And so we've talked about doing that. And it sounded pretty easy, and we actually were going to take it out through one of these board meetings. I don't know. Is it the one we're on now?
Yeah.
We presented that to Jim, and there were a couple of other thoughts that then came up and surrounded this that kind of made this discussion grow. And I'll try to make this simple because I had a slide when we were going to take this out. I still have a slide. But the way preference points works is if you're a person with 4 preference points, and this is different than our other drawings, like for a bighorn sheep or something. If you have 4 preference points, we go through everybody who's got 4 points first until all of them get what they want before we ever look at 3-point guys or 2-point guys or 1-point guys. So that kind of makes sure that we're taking all those people off the top. One suggestion is, well, maybe you leave the preference point thing, but instead of doing all the 4-point people first, maybe you do the first choice of everybody with 4 points, and then the first choice of everybody with 3 points, and the first, and so on. That's how we do all of our other draws right now. And some people said, well, if we gave everybody their first choice, whether they got 4, 3, 2, 1, whatever, then maybe it's okay if they still earn a point, if they, you know, if they didn't draw the first one. So that's another whole way of looking at it. It turns the way we do the draw completely sideways, you know. And that's where we got into a big discussion with Jim while he was still the director and kind of got spinning around. And then we said, well, do we need to just wait a year before we do anything or not? And so I think at that point, Jim felt like we really didn't have all the answers to preference points. We didn't know how all this people putting in for different units is going to shake out. We still don't. You know, we've got 1 year of data. I bet it'll look somewhat different next year after this next draw on these 30 units. So I think that the recommendation was just cool our jets for a minute and see how this all shakes out. But there's certainly a voice of public that says, don't be giving guys points. You're drawing good tags. You know, it kind of seems contrary to what we've done a lot around here. So
when you go to Colorado, like I put in for my high country buck hunt that I want and can't get till I have 9 points. And then in you put in for a muzzleloader hunt or something lesser, you get it every year. And you still build your points.
Yeah.
So
a guy right now put in for Southwest Desert and only has 400
permits. Difficult to draw.
Very unlikely he's going to draw out in that until he's got several preference points, maybe. Mm-hmm. And it could take him 5 years to get out of there, but he could put his second choice right now as, say, Zions, a desirable unit, and get it every year until he finally draws out the Southwest.
Because of all the points he was racking up while earning the Southwest.
Yeah. On a great unit that other people can't get. I think it's got to change. So my perspective is, yes, we need to wait another year now, but please come up with something that says that general season hunting is about opportunity, not about a second limited entry.
Yeah.
If you're donning the orange, it's causing you to lose your points.
Yep.
I think most of us probably agree with that.
I do too.
So
you just use the points on your first choice?
If you get it, your second choice or your third choice?
No, I'm saying right now, it's only on your first choice.
Yeah. And really, the reasons we put that in place for made sense, and they worked. It was just as universally liked as we're almost universally disliked in keeping it. These are some of the ramifications as we went to 30 units. So we're still trying to kind of our way through.
That's how it is in other states like it is now. I mean, I can understand both sides of the argument, but I don't think.
Nevada's different. You know, in Nevada, they draw the person, not the unit.
Yeah.
And they go through all your choices, and if you get a tag for any of those choices, your points are gone.
Yeah.
You don't have to put five choices, but a lot of guys do. They draw by the person, not by the unit.
In some states, several states do their draws that way. Well, I think, I don't have any idea how that, we're almost got as many questions after a first year of 30 units right now as we did before the first year of it. So this is something that I think we probably need to have a change as we move into next year. But a lot of heads were spinning right now as we kind of rolled into this, and we've still got so many questions and still looking at data and success rates and all kinds of things. So
perhaps, we can't change it for a year now. I don't see any way of doing that. We've lost the opportunity. But how about in 6 months, whenever we have our next work meeting, would that be long enough to come up with something internally that you think is a good answer? Run it back through us at least at that point?
Yeah, I think it would be good after we have the data back from the next draw, actually, because then we've got 2 years of data and we're seeing how if people are gaming this thing or not that that's a lot of real trend set of data, but
log for after the next the draw and we have the data from the draw.
I think you would see the
all
division.
All we're going to do is take that action log item tomorrow, the first action log item, and bump the dates, I think. So if we put it on the action log again for a report back to the board by the summer, maybe?
Yeah, that'd be appropriate. Thank you. Couldn't we give him some information?
The
next
work session is May 1st.
Pardon?
Do you want to shoot for that?
May 1.
Yeah.
We'd have that data by then. Not earlier than that.
The world's going to end in a couple weeks anyway. I mean, we're planning a lot on attendance at the Mayans told us that this is the end of it.
That's why I'm not buying any Christmas presents this year. Why, you know?
Why waste your time and effort, huh?
It should be a mass rush on the
27th. I've cashed in all my
chips. You're done, huh? Accounts,
it's old. I need to cash my Cabela's points when I heard you talking about cashing in stuff.
My money's gone. My wife sold to that.
Okay. What's that? We won't have the results, but I think we could have the data before that of where everybody drew out at.
The application data.
We could know application.
That's the crazy look. I've seen that before.
We could know application
That's
data.
That's why I was asking when's the next work session date. There's a training in August.
We'll work to get something on that. Yeah, I suspect we'll recommend a change on that preference point thing, but. We'll have a little more data to work with at that point. Make sure we're kind of doing the right thing, so we don't want to change it again a year later. So.
Okay, thank you, Director Sheehan. John.
I was asked to do a quick rundown on the wolf issues here, or kind of what we have, what we don't have, or whatever. And I guess the real quick summary. There's a lot up in the air. We don't have any definitive answers on what's going on, what's not. But I can run you through these notes that I put together really quickly. At first, I had a little side note. I had promised at the last meeting that I would keep you up to date on cougar issues in the Manti, Southwest Manti especially, and there hasn't been anything harvested there up to this date. So it's still quiet. So
no snow.
You haven't heard from me.
Bad conditions.
Might not be any harvest.
Yeah.
So it may not be any harvest. So
not even going out.
Because I'm here to tell you, I don't need snow. I do not need snow to catch lions. I need fresh snow. I need 3 inches of snow that is no longer than 2 hours old. Until you give me that, we're not catching.
Okay, I'll work on that. And I'll let you know how I do.
I had that the other day.
Friday night snow.
I need Friday night snow to catch a Saturday morning. That's what I need.
You're making it harder and harder on me.
Yeah. Yes.
All right, we'll do our. I'll go home and do the dance. Okay, should I continue?
Sorry.
Current status in the West. I did, you know, everybody I think is pretty familiar with how the whole delisting process. It basically took an act of Congress to get them delisted. There was a lot of battles and posturing with Wyoming, and that delayed it in Wyoming a little bit. But Wyoming finally got their plan together and got an acceptable plan to the service, so they got their delisting too. And so there's now currently hunts going on in all three of these states, and different ones are hitting quotas at different times.
So Wyoming is hunting now.
Yeah. They have basically the top little, you know, around Yellowstone. Every place else is a predator and shooting on sight, but then they've got some. And as far as Utah, yes, wolves have been blinking in and out of here since that one was caught back in 2002 that had wandered down from Lamar. It was pretty obvious because it had a radio collar on it.
Caught in a trap up on the Morgan.
Exactly. So they're bumping in and out. This 2012 thing is kind of interesting as I was processing the depredation claims. Wildlife Services did classify 3 calves as being probable wolf kills, and that was in that Hobble Creek area and around there. So it's not, again, it's still not a smoking gun. Were they wolves? Were they big dogs? Don't know. But it was something where, and it's on the radar screen. We have put together a wolf report database, and what this is it's relatively informal. So as people call in, we'll write down, we'll document who's seeing what, where. And what it does, it really provides sort of anecdotal feel for what's going on out there. Because there's a lot of different reports and things. The last one I got was someone in Saratoga Springs that saw wolves frolicking in the meadow and wanted it documented. Probably they weren't wolves. It's my guess if they're, because wolves don't frolic.
Poodles.
Exactly. So we have to weigh, you know, what's good evidence with what's not. I looked at 160 reports in the database. 16 of them were considered reliable. Of those, 3 of them were confirmed dog, hybrid, that kind of thing. There are 8 possible ones, and it's down to out of 160, maybe 5 that could have been wolves. Or fairly okay with it.
What criteria do you use to make the reliability?
There's a two-pronged method. Basically, you rate the reliability of the observer, or that somebody that's competent that has seen wolves before, and then the reliability of the circumstances, and it puts together a composite score. And
is that somewhere that we could see what that is? Is it in your Wolf Management Plan? Or?
It's. Or you mean the database?
Just the two criteria that you just talked about.
Oh.
We could send you the form that their guys fill out as they do it.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that.
It's still...
Just for personal reasons as much as anything.
Okay.
See if I'm reliable.
Were you one of them?
Oh, were you in there?
No.
Oh. Okay, I'm going to go change.
I just want
to always
John
want to know what
it meant
to be reliable, and maybe this will give
it's,
me a clue.
You know what? It's a subjective thing. It's a little bit of a, you know, it's some things is if someone is, they'll get a little better score if they've seen them before, worked with them, or something like that, and or if it's a, and then the last question on it, too, is what do you feel, you know, what is your opinion on wolves in Utah? Yeah. And so that goes from kill them all to I understand that they might need to be here. And that'll all just kind of go in there. And then you come up with a number, but it's still really subjective. Yeah. So
I'm no, that's exactly what I wanted to know. I have a class that we talk about these kind of things. And that's
classwork.
You bet.
Excellent.
So,
one less lecture.
Have you yet personally yourself laid eyes on what you believe to be a wolf in Utah?
In Utah, no. The thing that makes it complicated, and I've gone up looking for them, but it makes it complicated too because there are clearly, there's a lot of the rumors about this hybrid, some guy up there letting hybrids go. There are a lot of things I've seen in pictures that are dogs, and there are bigger animals and things. So there's nothing that's put me over the edge of saying, yeah, definitely. The other thing is the internet's a kind of a crazy thing because people post a picture that was clearly taken in Yellowstone, and they say, oh yeah, this was up just north of Salt Lake somewhere or something. So there's just craziness. Every time something hits the news about a report, and all of a sudden it's less about more wolves being seen and more about more people getting excited about it. So there's a lot of things that make it difficult to pull the trigger and say, yes, we have an established population. I will acknowledge that, yes, we have wolves popping in and out, but I won't go as far as to say, do we have any kind of breeding population? That I don't know. Let's see. The whole Spanish Fork thing is what I think prompted a lot of this. Back in March, Wildlife Services was flying their helicopter. They came across a few animals. They're big, large canids, definitely wolfy-looking things. They're still distant. No, nothing got captured. Don't have any hair scat or anything from those guys. So we had got nothing definitive other than, whoa, those things look like wolves. Then in March, we started to divert resources, grabbed a helicopter, flew around, looked for them, couldn't find anything. Then we started, Central Region really cranked it up and started to send someone in about every week to howl, to look for sign, to try to see what was going on, to gather scats. There was a carcass found of a moose carcass with scats near it. I sent in the DNA to the UCLA lab and they said it was a coyote. So we're getting like, we get like this close and then never get the threshold. Two carcasses of dog-like animals have been found in the area. One of the skulls sounds like it was more wolf-like. I didn't see that skull. But that one's gone off. Fish and Wildlife Service has it. It's gone off to their lab in Ashland. They're analyzing that one. A second carcass was found. That's off to the lab, too. That second one in the photo I saw, that really looked like dog to me.
The one I saw looked like he didn't have the long pointy.
Right,
he had
exactly.
a real
yep.
distinct
exactly.
forehead, unlike a wolf. And the guy that I talked to said, well, it's got two bullet holes right in the back of the head. And I says, well, how are you going to get... I says, that's somebody's Great Dane that they put down, buddy. I says, you ain't going to get close enough to a wolf to put two of them right in the back of the head. Oh, no, it's a wolf. It's a wolf. I'd eat your hat if it's a wolf, but...
It's this cougar dog that kept chasing deer, probably. So.
Probably one of Calvin's cow dogs.
Could be.
You don't have any Great Danes for cows.
So a lot of those things
can't
are...
Can't afford the dog food for them.
So it's kind of crazy. People get excited about it, you know, and I look at the five probable confirmed sightings, and then if I look at the map I have outside of my cubicle, I think we've got 57 confirmed Bigfoot sightings in the state. So when we look at kind of how people get excited, what's reliability, what's not...
What's the reliability criteria for Bigfoot sightings? That's what happened.
That was before.
Yeah, you'll have to ask Rudy, who's not here anymore.
Rudy had that.
Rudy's out in your class.
Yeah.
So, that's the point there is one of these things we're paying attention to, but you know, people have a tendency to get a little crazy. So where are we next? A little thing on the future. We're working obviously closely with Wildlife Services. I'm putting together an MOU with those guys right now, but I'll outline what they'll do if wolves are in the list, or if they find animals in the either listed zone or delisted zone. The long and short of it, what it's going to look like if they're in the delisted zone, Wildlife Services, if they see an animal looks like a wolf, they're welcome to shoot it, which I'm sure they will. If it's in the listed area, then we'll coordinate with Fish and Wildlife Services to find out what's going to happen. I'm trying to, as much as if, say, a coyote trapper captures a wolf in a trap, I'd like to get a collar on it rather than just put it down right there, even if it's in the delisted zone, because that's the easiest way to find out if you have more. Do that Judas Wolf sort of approach. Get a collar on one, find out a few more, and then we can actually manage and do something. So that'd be really useful. If it's not in a trap, though, if they're in an airplane or something, then they'll just shoot it, however. Finally, we have our wolf management plan, but right now the wolves are really, it's in the realm of the legislature. And, as far as the delisted zone, we have a pretty clear instruction to not let them establish. Up in northern Utah, and then south of the line, it's all Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's something that's sort of out of our hands, except at a very kind of monitoring sort of level.
Any sense for what Fish and Wildlife Service's response is going to be to sightings or actual wolves in the listed zone? Are they going to?
They're being
cooperative.
They're being very cooperative. Mike Jimenez is on the speed dial, as are the other folks here in the state, and we've got a good working relationship right now. And they're definitely saying, we want you guys to take the lead as much as possible and make those decisions and stuff. So that's.
So there's the possibility then that wolves in the listed zone still may be removed from the state, depending on what they are going to do, or are they going to say, we're going to let them stay?
The threshold, Mike, for them to authorize removal is quite high.
Okay.
They'll be very cooperative for us to be able to get collars on and monitor the situation, but they've set a pretty high threshold for authorizing removal.
Okay.
Is that livestock depredation or comparable?
It'll be a chronic livestock depredation issue, not a single incident. Is kind of the way the precedent that they've set, what they've told us will be the threshold.
Is that in writing anywhere, or is that just conversation?
I think we know we have that, and we asked the question specifically and got a response back from Mike Jimenez, and that's essentially what it said. Not when we were dealing with trying to figure out what was going on with up in Spanish Fork.
But we'll continue. That's a good point, though. We'll get that. We might end up doing an MOU with the Fish and Wildlife Service as well, and that'd be a good way to get that question answered beforehand, before we're in the thick of it.
But we do have, at least in response to pretty direct questions, that's what their intention is right now.
Okay.
I mean, that was 6 to 8 months ago. I don't think it's changed.
Okay. Thanks.
So. Again, it's in the hands of the legislature. We need additional legislation would be required if we weren't going to, if we'd want to treat these as harvestable species or something like that.
You're talking in the delisted zone.
In the delisted zone.
Didn't we get a change in the classification of wolves?
It was tried. I heard it died as it was going.
So classification in what way are you?
Didn't we take a bill to the legislature to change them from
fur bears? Same as
fur bears.
Fur bears.
Yeah.
Right.
Right. But that was just a license permit issue.
But it didn't go through.
Right.
It didn't go through. So that's something that I know might be there's some benefits to having that happen.
Isn't that a prerequisite though to having a hunt?
Well.
Go ahead, Greg.
There's two schools of thought on this.
both of them. Well, there's a school of thought that says, do we even want to make people, if ultimately we have a delisting, we have that in a portion of the state now, do we want to turn this into a species like bears and cougars and manage them that way? Or, and if so, you do what we talked about last year, which is you have permits and you sell them and you do a variety of things. The other thing is, do we want to see those treated more similarly to a coyote, an uncontrolled species, where if you see them, you kill them, and you don't have to have licenses and permits and season dates and quotas and all that. So, I mean, depending on where you fall down on that side of the equation. So a bill went to the legislature last year. It said the licenses and permits, and we're going to try to, you know, have some control or make some, you know, potential money on this structure. But I, you know, seem to be aware there's others out there who like to treat them as a coyote kind of approach. So
what about those that just don't want them killed?
That's there as well.
They have that right now until the Fish and Wildlife Services delist the rest of
the
state.
Those people have 90% of the state.
Yeah, they're pretty good right now. So.
they don't view it that way though.
Yeah.
I mean, that issue came up in at the WAFWA meetings for places like Washington State, where there's a lot of outcry against, you know, just killing wolves because of wolves.
Do we think then that we would have trouble getting a bill through the legislature that would allow the start of hunting? Because if we,
well,
that is the more moderate approach that doesn't wave a wet red flag to many parties and would allow some control of wolves in the state, as opposed to declassified no hunting at all. But until the entire state is declassified, if we go for the coyote status, aren't we just waving a red flag like Wyoming did, delaying things for years?
Well, and that's just the point I was going to make, Ernie. In the wolf world, it's so politically charged, so polarized that every action has an equal reaction. And one of the things that the service has to look at in making a delisting decision is the adequacy of regulatory mechanisms.
Yep, in the state.
That are existing before, yeah, that are at the state level. And so we need to look at the end game of getting them delisted and try to avoid the temptation to make statements, because if we're making those statements, could turn around and bite us and prevent the end goal of delisting statewide. And that's the message that we've delivered to the legislature several times, and so far they've been, you know, we've had moderate success in getting that point of view.
So your question is, could that still happen? You know, probably. I think, you know, the legislature has for the moment sent a message, you know, well, you know the message, you know, nothing at the moment, but I think there are two things we don't have right now. One, we don't know for sure what's going to happen with the delisting. And two, we don't have any that we're aware of, you know, packs of wolves in the state. And this whole thing is not over for you as a board or our legislature or the Fish and Wildlife Service or anybody who wants to file any number of lawsuits that could occur out there and different things.
There was another filed the other day.
Yeah.
Defenders of Wildlife. I mean, it's never going to go away. And they didn't file in
Pennsylvania,
Montana. They filed like in Washington.
Yeah, Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
That's right, they did.
Yeah. Which district court they're in, they all pick and choose where they think they have the best opportunity to win their argument based on the makeup of the judges. It's all a game.
This is. It's like Kevin said, it's pretty politically charged, and there are a lot of, you know, the Fish and Wildlife Service, I think, is keenly aware of all the aggravation that this is causing. They're also trying to address the Mexican wolf situation plays very heavily into decisions they make here, and that may have as big of a decision on a delisting, you know, how they can address these Mexican wolves as anything we as a state or even other states could do, because that's a population they're very interested in protecting. And so, I don't know. I think we're going to just be adaptive as we see. I don't know that racing in and getting a law passed in the state right now is going to necessarily change a whole lot of things, you know, or you know, changing those, the classification of those from fur bearers to their unique species.
So right now, your direction, our direction, is to not let a pack become established or wolves become established in the delisted area. So that means one's okay.
Established means the way it's defined as a breeding pair.
Okay, yeah, but yeah, two, unless you can prove they're both males, one of them's got to be killed.
Well, we don't have information at the level to make decisions at that level anyway, Ernie, so it's kind of a moot point. But the important part about the legislation that was passed is it said avoid or prevent establishment until wolves are delisted statewide, and at that point we implement the wolf plan. So it's still protected us from this idea that there are no regulatory mechanisms in place, because as soon as wolves are delisted throughout the state, the Wolf Management Act goes away, because it kind of put a sunset date on itself, that as soon as they're delisted throughout the whole state, this direction is no longer applicable. And so it still keeps us in the realm of being able to say we have regulatory mechanisms in place in the state of Utah that are applicable to wolves once they're delisted throughout the state.
And if that kicks in, we need to have a discussion. Do we need to change the classification to its own, you know, from fur bearer to a species similar to?
And we could allow harvest now under the, there's classified as a fur bearer. We could allow harvest under that classification. Right now.
Just you need a trapping,
whatever,
certification, whatever.
Bill and I were talking on the way down about this a little bit. The wolf plan comes up in 2015. Does it make any sense for the division and the board to go through that bloody public process?
Let's see what the landscape looks like in 2014. And I think we ought to look and see what the landscape looks like in 2014. And if there's, we want to be ahead of a delisting and have something in place before it happens.
Well, we probably have to have something in place before it was delisted. Ain't that part of the?
Not necessarily, because they're protected under statute. They're listed as protected wildlife.
But Utah wouldn't be delisted unless we have a plan in place that the feds felt comfortable with. And technically, we do have a plan.
We have a plan. It's never been reviewed because they've told us they don't plan on recovering wolves. This is.
If you want to get your head spinning, we could get Marty in here, and pretty soon you'll just be shaking it, you know?
It doesn't make sense to me to automatically start doing a new wolf plan in 2014 if we don't have some indication that something's going to change in the national level and the delisting and all the rest of it, because there's just no use turning your head into a bloody pulp.
And I think we'll have a good feel for that by then. They plan on doing a comprehensive plan that will go through the Federal Register to deal with wolves in what they call the white space, areas where, you know, right now wolves are listed in Florida. Well, wolves never existed in Florida, so why are they listed? You know, there's a whole bunch of the country that was probably inappropriately wolves were listed under the Endangered Species Act 35 years ago. They're going to deal with that. They'll deal with the Midwest. They'll deal with a lot of areas. We'll have a better indication on what. Maybe Utah will be included in that, and we'll get the state delisted. That's probably a long shot at this point, but. That's certainly a case that we'll make between now and 2015.
But it could be an option for the board just to extend the current plan from 2015 to 2019
sure, or until there's reasonable evidence that we're going to circumstance the change.
It was pretty brutal. It was pretty brutal.
It will be. Anytime you bring up bulls, it always will be. But I wanted to, before we leave this topic, John won't toot his own horn, but we're pretty lucky to have, you know, John's got experience with wolves from the beginning. And so to have his expertise now within our realm is going to be pretty important to us going forward in terms of evaluating whether we have them and what do we do and how do we treat them. That's, you know, you spent 10 or 15 years doing a lot of that in your former careers.
Ironically, I have more experience with coyotes. That's worked out.
He's a coyote farmer. We all know he's a coyote farmer.
Greg, I saw an email somewhere where you're going to have a legislator from Ogden want a bill for the division this session.
On what
topic? Well, I can't remember. That's why I wanted to ask you. That's supposed to be non-controversial.
We have any aquatics folks here? We've got a bill out there that deals with wasting of wildlife. Is Mike
here? Oh, that's what it was, yeah. Wasting of wildlife.
And
it's going to give the board some latitude to add some species that don't have to be salvaged and utilized, such as carp. That's what it's meant, geared at. And it should be very non-controversial.
Let me ask you, John, on coyotes. What's an update on that?
Two, as of the end of last month, so as of December 1, 2,351 have been turned in. So we paid out $117,550. There's a big peak that last 3 or 4 days of November, 509 coyotes were turned in.
Why the peak?
I think we're starting to get towards better fur, and you're starting to get people turning pelts now rather than just carcasses.
The trappers are getting the gauges, not just people out calling and shooting. The trappers are now...
They're just getting wrapped up then.
Yeah. So what I think we'll see is a little bit of a ramp up for December, January, February, and then I think as we get back, March, April, May, June, it's probably going to plummet. I'm guessing we'll turn in there'll be six to seven thousand coyotes turned in, and which will still leave around 100,000 to 200,000 left for contracts. That's projection. I know Greg's got a dog in
the I'm 10,000.
Exactly. So I'm not doubting you. But that's just where it looks like it was. It's not publicly anyway. And that's his trajectory. And we know more and more every month. I don't have a good map of where they've been taken yet. Hopefully we'll get up going on that here in a couple weeks. But that's where we are.
So are you going to look at any studies on doe survival rate and fawn survival rate versus where coyotes been taken and
absolutely.
Such?
Absolutely. I'm pretty excited about being able to overlay coyote take with what our fawn doe is in the specific area. So that's pretty exciting to have that spatial overlap. That's going to be really useful.
So you expect you're going to spend your money this year?
I suspect we will have surplus this year unless we get to our 10,000.
We have carry forward authority on that from legislature. So if we do have 100,000 left over, we'll just add to next year.
And that'll turn over, and that'll just next year turn over into contracts.
Yeah.
Which will be. That's a good.
And do they still give you the same amount next year?
Yes.
Yeah. Does the contract started to kick in yet?
The contracts won't be until. So what we need to do is build up a database of people that are qualified as preferred vendors. And the way to qualify as preferred vendor is to show that you've been part of this program and harvested so many, killed so many coyotes. And then what I'll do is, this time next year, we'll pick off of that database and see who's the people that have turned in the most and that are interested in the program, and then we will contact them or they contact us to start it up. So any contracts will be this time next year.
We'll be in place by this time.
And what we would do, if that's not clear, is those individuals, we may say, okay, here's an area where we're having a lot of fawn loss or something. We could pay them under some, you know, pricing scheme that we developed to go in and actually hunt for certain ones. They might be getting, you know, their revenue might be more than $50 per,
that have to produce in that area before we're paying them, right?
Yeah, but we'd go in and we want to make sure, you know, like John said, that they know what they're doing. They've killed so many. we trust that they're been honest with our system. You know, they're not, you know, a variety of things. We'll come up with a handful of people and say, go get these really tough ones. It might not be as easy to get as most people would want to hunt, but we feel like they're in a real critical area. So.
And in turn, you might get paid a little bit, you know, more.
How's the money allocated that's tied to license sales? Is that, does that go into your budget and you pull out the money to spend?
There are two elements at the legislature of this. There was a $5 fee increase on big game, and that should raise about $600,000. And the legislature funded $500,000 of general fund. The $500,000 we're using for this program that John Kevin just described, the $600,000 we're right now contracting with Wildlife Services to do,
so that's
targeted take throughout the state. And
that money then, though, is if you're flexible with that, if you don't raise $600,000, you don't have to spend $600,000. Is that?
I think we'll raise that much. We contracted with Wildlife Services for $600,000, so they're going to get the money, but we should have that much. So.
$500,000 pot, we split 50-50 ag and wildlife.
No, there was actually $750,000 passed. $500,000 came here. $250,000 went directly to the Department of Agriculture.
Okay, thank you. So,
and Kevin has been working closely with Department of Ag and John to identify where we want that work done. So we're not just giving them money and who knows what happens with it. And so, but it's been a good partnership, I think. So we'll, you know, we'll hope they're out there getting it done for us. So.
You have to spend that $600,000 on coyote control, though, right? That doesn't go elsewhere.
That's in code, so that's something that won't change ever unless somebody runs a bill.
The $600,000 is in code, or just
the $600,000? The $500,000 is ongoing general fund to us, but that's something if the legislature ever needed money for something else, that's under their control, but they can't change unless they run a bill, they can't redirect this $5.
So I guess, but right now, $500,000 has to be spent on coyote removal as well under the current bill.
I guess my question is, does it say in code that you have to spend $600,000 every year on coyote control raised by license sales?
It doesn't use the 500, the 600. That's just kind of what we know it is. It says $5 of every big game hunting.
So there's flexibility in there. You're not forced to spend $600,000.
If we have, some of the permits that have more variability, like that applies to, say, cow out permits that kind of probably move up and down more than most of our other types of permits and different things. So, yeah, that'll vary a little bit each year. So we'll contract accordingly with Wildlife Services. And I think they want to have this be successful. We're not required to transfer all of that to Wildlife Services. So if we feel like they never did any good with it, it would retain here. But it just has to be spent on coyote control. So.
Ernie, you had something?
John, how about an update on cougar harvest, especially female cougar harvest?
Oh, that's it. Yeah, nothing. Nothing yet.
There's no snow, nobody's killed anything.
Right.
And statewide, there's no over harvest in any area?
Nothing's changed from the last numbers that you gave me, because there hasn't been any additional harvest since then, because we haven't had any snow. This year's season really hasn't kicked off yet.
Maybe this weekend.
The season is going now. It's only been a few years maybe 6-7 years that we slid the opener of the cougar up. It used to start in the middle, like the third weekend of December. So, I mean, it's
been probably 10 years that it's been the end of the season.
Yeah, we're still getting going.
So I started, the limit entry opened on November 14th. So that's how long we've been up. There actually has been, Heather came in just with, there's been one male taken in the state, but it was in Southwest Utah. So that's all we have. It's one cougar.
Another question for the director. I think we were told that the division had fronted $8 million for
fire restoration
rehabilitation, with an anticipation that would be reimbursed by the legislature.
Well, a portion of it, yes.
Yeah.
We Quick update. Yeah, we're addressing several hundred thousand acres of land. Some of that money is from BLM, from some of their fire recovery fund, I think they call it something like that. We ask for about $4.5 million from our state legislature to go along with what fire, forestry, fire, and state lands had asked, and that's quite a bit higher number, somewhere I believe around $18 million. So, yeah, those two coupled together is a pretty big request. I think that will be funded. Director Styler upstairs worked pretty close with our legislative committee and others to before we stuck our neck out to make sure there's a pretty strong commitment to fund that. Because we don't have an extra $4.5 million lying around. So I think it'll be pretty solid. In one direction I want to see us move down the road is rather than every year forestry fire goes and spends the money as soon as the fires start. And so the legislature's pretty well bound to fund that later or acknowledge that they'll have a large deficit in their budget. They don't really have a choice. Things like this rehabilitation, you know, they're not as tied to having to deal with that. What I'd like to see us do, and what I'm hoping we'll be able to work through with the legislature, is our cost of rehab will be part of the request, kind of the mandatory request that they come back with. So we're not out there having to hold out the hand right after they feed them for the money they've already spent. And I think if we move forward with that, just with that acknowledgement that whether we have a developed cost per acre at certain, elevation or terrain or vegetative type, we get reimbursed for that automatically. So we're not up there, begging for money when we know they're going to get. We want to be part of their guaranteed list. So.
Part as of right now, you're going to have to go up there in January.
We turn in a request in September for those funds. So that's gone through the governor's office.
Okay.
His budget will come out probably this week, potentially, or the first of next week. I expect they'll recommend funding for that. I expect the legislature will do it, but we can't continue to be at this risk profile of spending money for fire rehab, not knowing for sure if that's going to be funded. So I think we just need to make it be part of what forestry takes to them and say, if your house burns down, you try to rebuild that thing. You don't just say, well, here's the money for the, fire department who came and put it out. It's the whole process. We can't afford to have our habitats continue to be jeopardized by these fires without some ability to have that funded. I think they'll fund that this year, but we've got to have a new mindset of this. Because these are just too big of dollars.
I think the legislature is amenable to going with the governor on this one.
I think they will, but they don't love it because it pre-spends their money before the year ever starts. And so they've never been a big fan of how this works, but nobody's ever had a better idea for how you fund fires that have already happened.
Does this funding change take statute, or is it just by passage of process within the appropriations?
Just within the appropriations. So.
So all they've got to do is say this is how we're doing business.
Well, Forestry Fire says our fire budget for the year, they have a small budget, say $3 million a year for fighting fires. This year it was $22 million on non-federal lands, which is what they have to pay for. They pay for school trust lands, private lands, different lands that are out there. Well, our properties, our WMA, so all of those lands, are part of that. And they said, well, we overspent our budget by $18, $19 million. Either you can pay us or just we'll be over budget. But the money got spent 6 or 7 months ago. What do you want us to do about it? So it's a difficult situation. So it kind of becomes the first money taken off the top of the state budget discussions every single year. There's not much they can do, but some years we don't have extreme fires and they're pretty close to doing it within their budgets. This year wasn't one of those. These were lower elevation fires early on that had more private lands and different things. So.
We're done?
No. Before we break up, can we just brief you on one thing that you'll see tomorrow?
Sure.
To change. Scott's got a thing that's kind of come to light on the the CWMU rule that we just wanted to, obviously we can't do anything. We just want to tell you where we're headed, and that there's more chance for discussion now than there will be tomorrow. And it's
this handout from the Dropbox.
Yeah. Okay. Hopefully it's not that small. Now this matter came up. This hasn't gone through the racks, and it's a season date rule matter that came up when we were looking at the guidebook. It came up that the September 1st opener for the Bucks and Bulls season starts on a Sunday this year. Anyways, by code it says the Utah Wildlife Board may allow season-owned protected wildlife to commence on any day of the week except Sunday. And I think this is one of the few places in our rules where we have specific dates that start on a certain date instead of a day of the week. So anyways, what it's done is caused a problem that it affects the buck deer, bull elk, pronghorn, and moose also. And potentially down the road, it would affect a 61-day buck hunt that goes into November, because normally that starts on September 11th. And then potentially it would affect the antlerless hunt also if the antlerless hunt start on August 15th by the rule. And so it would affect that down the road. I guess it'd happen once every 7-8 years. I haven't calculated that out, but we have a couple solutions that we've come up with. This was done through Marty, and the first one, option one, is this is the one that we prefer, is a default backward, which would take a rule amendment. And like I said, this hasn't gone through the racks, and I was going to put it in my presentation tomorrow. And basically, it would be addition to the rule that would clarify that it wanted to that we needed to have a default backward. And the wording would be, notwithstanding the season provisions in this section, any season described in this subsection 1 that begins on a Sunday will default and commence to the Saturday before. That's defaulting backwards. And what that does, it would put it overlapping with the archery season that's designated for the CWMU, which starts the general archery season for buck deer or bull elk. And that goes through August 31st. This would overlap to that 31st date. And we talked about it was talked about with law enforcement and amongst us. And it's really not that big of a problem, because the CWMU already has the ability to adjust their seasons and their hunters wherever they want. So the burden would be on them to adjust their season, not overlap archery hunters and rifle hunters. But the archery season, I mean, potentially could go through the 31st of October anyway. So the second option would be default forward, and this would take a rule amendment also. Not it would, but it wouldn't. It would say that notwithstanding the season length provisions in this section, any season described in subsection 1 that begins on Sunday will default and commence the following Monday. This option, it's basically what our rule defaults to right now. It's just not spelled out clearly what the intent of that is. This would give a clear legal definition of that.
And you're saying, I think, that what your rule defaults to now, this would also apply to the start of grouse season, the start of...
This is just in the CWMU rule.
No, but I mean the same thing about hunts starting on a Sunday.
Yeah, we make sure very, you know, because the other rules don't say a specific date. They don't say September 1st. But because this rule specifically says September 1st in the rule, if that happens on a Sunday, we needed a mechanism to know, because it's going to happen occasionally once every few years.
Okay, so the grouse start on September 1st is not in rule.
It's not in rule.
Just in proclamation.
Yes.
Right. Okay, I got it.
Yes.
And that can be adjusted to a Saturday if it needs to be. So it can be a day forward or a day backward.
Right. Because this one actually says September 1st, it causes this conflict occasionally. It says September 1st, it says September 15th, and it says September 11th. It has those three dates specifically in it. So each time that comes up, This would just in the rule, we wouldn't have to deal with it one by one. It would just automatically, the rule would have a mechanism to adjust when it happens moving forward. That's all we're asking for you to do.
And right now in the guidebook, we've had to default to the have the season start September 2nd, you know, without a rule change or anything. And that's how it'll be published unless there's an amendment. If you guys can't, without going through the racks.
We'd rather them start on a Saturday.
Yeah, the reasons being that, if you take, otherwise you take a day of elk hunting away from these guys. They're going to have a gap. They're going to have one day that they're going to have to shut down their CWMU because their archery season is going to end on the 31st, and we can't open their rifle season until the 2nd, and it happens to be right at the time when the elk rut's hot and heavy. And it's a day they're going to want to have hunters there. They can have hunters on in Sunday as long as we're not opening in a season on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. You don't.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
You don't extend the season dates and right. The time period, so they're still getting the same number of days to hunt. You're not right. Giving them an extra day.
Well, the one
or taking a day away.
It would give them one extra day on their. It would on the years that this happened, they would have a 62-day buck season instead of a 61-day deer season because the rule also says that the buck season can go through October.
Well, it can be October 31st, or if they opt with the November option, they can go to November 10th. We're not giving them days on the tail end of it. We're giving them an extra day on the
If you go to the Monday.
Then they go to the 60 days.
They go to 60 days. What it does is it makes every CWMU, with the exception of some of the ones that have the November option for their buck deer, will have a date that they set out where they're going to be accounting. And so it'd be more consistent. I talked to the CWMU Association, Ken Clegg and Todd Black. Ken Clegg had some concerns about it starting the 2nd, the Monday following. Todd Black actually called 26 CWMUs and asked them how it would affect him. And he said one of them already had hunts booked, but he said it probably wouldn't be that big of a deal. When I ran the options by him, he said, well, as far as the CWMU Association is concerned, you know, we would probably prefer the option to default backwards to the 31st, the day before, instead of the one after.
So this isn't something we see as being real controversial. It's just a technical fix to fix something that's going to come up occasionally.
It's legislators' fault.
Yeah. So as long as you're comfortable with it, we'll present it and ask you to act on it tomorrow. This small section, even though it didn't go through the racks, because we don't see it as being a huge.
You're not going to take it to the racks at all, then.
That'd be fast.
If we took it to the racks,
the CWMU rule is coming up for you tomorrow.
Just a heads up.
Bring it on. Let's do it.
Okay.
I have a question, and are we getting ready to break up?
Yeah, we got one more thing to go, but go ahead.
Well, I'll wait until we get through with one more thing.
We can have a photo wall.
Well, SFW's bringing in their big check or a replica of it of what they're paying us for this year's conservation permits. I think it's $1.1 million or something. I think they're just coming up the stairs right now, and they wondered if the board would be willing to be recipients of that check. So they can have a photo moment, I guess.
Whose name's on it?
This is that.
So can I ask my question?
Well, we asked for 2 years' worth of money this year, this time, if you remember, the last year's.
And,
it's a 30%, but 2 years' worth of it, I think. So.
My question was, and I sent this out to the board because I've had a couple of people ask me about why we don't allow more than a one power scope on a muzzleloader, and I'm assuming this has been discussed lots of times in the past, but I don't know the history, and I just want to know if that's something that needs to be or should be discussed in the future, or if what's already been discussed is sufficient to tell the folks that have asked me this question so that they don't worry about it anymore.
Mike, their query or their thought is that a one-power scope, because they're older, they
I still can't use the one power scope.
Well, I don't. I've never used the one power scope, but I know the last time I shot a rifle, being older than I, much older than I look, I couldn't see the bead on the end of the barrel. And so, I mean, I know what they're experiencing, as do several of you in this room. But so I don't know if a one power scope doesn't take care of that problem or not. I'm assuming it doesn't. Otherwise, they wouldn't be asking about it.
Well, one power scope's a negative magnification. I mean, I'm sitting here looking at you, if you look at your one power scope, it's going to make you look smaller.
But it does fix the visual acuity problem. Although if you have a short range visual acuity problem, you now need to have what your reading glasses on when you look.
Yeah, so, well, that's the issue, is the close-up vision.
They would have to have reading glasses.
Several other states do allow different
magnifications.
And I'm just, we're trying to be squeaky traditional.
But
we're not, if we put a scope
on
it. Quit
making light rifles and whatever else, you know.
The trade-off's going to be, and we, you know, we've tried to keep, although it's arguable at this point, a muzzleloader somewhat defined as a primitive weapon.
Yeah.
And like I said, that's arguable. One of the things that, because we haven't outlawed inlines and those things, we have stuck with the, you know, open sights or a one power scope. You can actually, with a lot of the red dots, they have zero magnification. They're just the same as looking through, you know, right. Just as looking each other. Right now, you get away from the negative magnification stuff that John was talking about. The trade-off, we could go and let them put any scope they want. What that's going to do is increase success rates with muzzleloaders, which in turn is going to decrease buck-to-doe ratios and decrease opportunity, because we're going to be able to put fewer tags out there. So that's the trade-off. We've chosen to limit success somewhat by not allowing scopes and be able to provide more people the opportunity to hunt because it's a lower success weapon.
Well, if there's an option out there that fixes the problem, I mean I don't see any problem with that. But if you're talking about opportunity, if you don't have an option that fixes the problem, then you limit folks.
Right. There is. They can put a red dot scope on, which is zero magnification. And you can adjust how far away that is on your gun. You can put a zero power scope, which still crosshairs, but again, like John said, that actually makes it look smaller than it does in real life. So there are ways to be able to not have to look through a front sight of it.
And the red dot gets outstanding comments and reviews on the
internet. They have what they call a hollow sight, which is no magnification.
Just the lens. Sight?
Well, no, but it has the dot, and it takes away like the angle problem you have with some red dots, and they're actually extremely accurate. Yep. But they don't give you the magnification that the 20 power scope Crandall has on his.
We've got muzzleloader companies right now that are advertising their guns in lines. Hmm? They're shooting 1-inch groups at 300 plus yards. If we're going to add...
That's not very primitive.
With a muzzle?
Now, if my contention would be, if we're going to add the ability to use 4-power and 8-power scopes, then we don't need a muzzleloader shooting anymore. We just, what's the difference between shooting a Ruger number one?
Well, the thing is, they can use... If I want to hunt with my muzzleloader with a 9-power scope, I can do that if I hunt during the rifle season.
No, you can't. No, you can't.
This is any weapon.
It says any legal weapon. And a muzzleloader with more than a one-power scope on it is not a legal weapon. That's an issue Marty would like to address. And
I don't like that rule.
We've had people get in trouble. Well, we write warnings on them and tell them.
So really, that doesn't make sense. During the any weapon season, I should be able to hunt with any
We refer back to the definition of a legal weapon, and if you go back to the definition of a legal muzzleloader, it does not include a muzzleloader with a scope larger than...
So do we need to fix that?
We could. Marty would like to. Let me give you a little history on the one-power scope.
They suck.
It's been around for a long, long time. The last time it was reviewed by Lenny Reese, who was our hunter education coordinator. And he put an ad hoc task force committee together to address primitive weapon issues. And this obviously was one of them. And it went the rounds and it went through the rack and board process. And the one scope was, one power scope was sustained at that point in time for the reasons Kevin's thought about. That wasn't our idea. That went through the public process. And it was actually the muzzleloaders who were involved in that process.
How long ago was that?
It was probably 10 or 12 years ago.
Yeah, it's been a while.
I got in on a couple of those meetings. It's interesting.
But we did not address the one power scope during the anti-illegal weapon. And we could do an exemption for that, I think. The other one that we could talk about addressing would be crossbows during the anti-illegal weapon, too.
Well, that's
an increasing number of people who use crossbows that like to use them during the anti-illegal weapons season.
If somebody's crazy enough to want to hunt with a crossbow, that's anything other than zombie season.
So.
All right.